Brian Noonan is playing on the radio, baby.
You know, I have found in my travels that all the best things in life happen after 2 a.m. Because after 2 a.m. is when things get, audience, say it with me, legendary.
I want to thank Brian Noonan for going on.
What do you do?
I'm a communicator.
Must be a new kind of thing.
Drop a dime on this fool.
Boy, I tell you, it gets out of hand in a hurry.
Well, it's the big show. Yes, it's a big, bad show tonight.
Morning, welcome. Glad you're with me. Brian Noonan in for Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN Wednesday morning. Oh my goodness, the week is half over. It's hump day, Dan, if that's what you want to believe. Sure, we're on the hump of the big week, and then we just slide down the end. Big show planned for you tonight. We're going to have a lot of fun. 312-981-7200 is how you get involved in the program. When you call in, you will be talking to the aforementioned Dan Shugrue. He's the executive producer of the Nick DiGilio program. If you're nice to him, you get to me. That's how it works. You can also text at that same number, 312-981-7200. I don't know the science behind it. I just know both numbers work equally well. Facebook and Twitter, it's Brian Noonan Show. You can keep in touch with us there as well. We're going to talk to a guy who I think has one of the coolest jobs on the planet at 1:30. David Alan Arnold. You may not know his name, but you've seen his work if you've seen any TV shows or movies, or if you are watching Yellowstone Live on the National Geographic Channel this week, which is a phenomenal, phenomenal show. He is a airborne cinematographer. He shoots movies and TV and film from a helicopter. Very, very exciting. So we'll talk to him about what it's like to work on Yosemite Live, which is, as I said, unbelievable, and some of the other projects he's worked on. He also has a new book. We're going to talk about summer chores, what you should do yourself, what you should pay someone else to do. We'll get into that. Things men and women should never say once they pass 50. And I know for most of us here at the, for most of you, Dan doesn't have to worry about it. Esmeralda, Vic, they don't have to worry about this. I do, and many of you might as well, or you might be close. Take these as cautionary tales for what you want to avoid when you hit a certain age. So we got all of that, some secrets to college admissions, and so much more. A lot of somebody's already asking for PETA. There's always PETA in the building. When Brian Noonan is here, there is PETA. Let's get that straight. There's absolutely no problem with the PETA. I was terrified yesterday morning as I left the confines of the studio because I've been parking in a garage a couple blocks away. I won't say where because, you know, you never know what ne'er-do-wells may be waiting for me. Let's just say it's somewhere in the vicinity of Chicago. Now, I realize that this is a major urban center. I know that in major urban centers, sometimes there are rodents that scurry about unencumbered. I haven't really run into them. I ran into a couple in New York when we were moving Molly there. I haven't really run into any here in Chicago until last night. I was walking down the stairs to go into the building where the garage I'm at it, and all of a sudden, this giant rat came shooting across the stairs where I was going down, and I let out an audible yelp. I'm not proud of it, but I was like, ah, honestly, like that. A high-pitched, I don't want to say girlish squeal, but, you know, like a young, nubile child. I lost my mind. And so I'm like, okay, I froze for a minute, and it scurried into some flowers or underbrush, whatever, because there's a nice landscaping at this building, which made me doubly surprised that there were rodents running around. Then I shrieked again because as I get down the stairs and I start to go, it ran from one flower bed to the other, like right next to me. And I jumped. I was like, if I had had a chair, I would have climbed up on it and shrieked and held up my skirt while my pearls, hung around my neck. It was horrifying. And I realized there's certain things, and maybe we all have these, that you have an irrational fear of. Now, I'm much bigger than a rat. You know, even the Chuck E. Cheese rat, I'm much bigger than that one. And he's a robotic rat. And I know people say he's a mouse. Nah, look close. Look at the big teeth. Look at a pointy snout. That Chuck E. Cheese thing is a rat. Which is why I'm proud to say, I have very few things that I'm proud to say. Never been in a Chuck E. Cheese. I raised an adult woman and never had to go into a Chuck E. Cheese. Can you say the same, Dan Shigrew?
No, I was there about 8 months ago.
Horrifying. That is not, yeah. I don't know. Maybe I judge from the outside. I know there's a lot of violence at Chuck E. Cheese lately. You know why? Because people are freaked out that a giant rat is talking to them. And they just have to fight. Were you in any brawls?
Not this time.
Okay. See, part of the deal is do they serve liquor there?
At certain ones they do, yes.
Yes, see? You get people liquored up, and then they got a rat talking to them. Things are going to get dicey. But anyway, I'm terrified of mice and rats and snakes. I've had to catch mice at my house, at all my homes, which sounds bad, doesn't it? Like, move out of a tenement. But you know, anywhere you live, you can get a mouse. No big deal. In the winter, they would come in the garage at the old house. They come on the back porch at this house. They've never actually been, I've never had to catch them in the living area. They're always in an ancillary room, you know, whether it's the garage or whether it's the back porch. And I can do it. I'll set the traps, and I know. But then when I have to go, when I hear the telltale snap, because I go old school. I'm not for this, let's put a glue trap down. Because we did that once at my parents' house. They were doing some construction, and there was a hole behind the toilet. And we knew a rat got in because one of my brothers, number two, used to spend an inordinate amount of time in his room. Okay? So he would eat in there and stuff, and one night he awoke screaming because a mouse was dragging a Fritos bag across the floor of his room. Same day we found out that my dad was freaked out by mice too, because instead of rushing into my brother's room to save him, my dad went down to the living room and just sat on the couch. Just sat there. Would not move, wouldn't say a word. I remember him sitting there in his just a white T-shirt and his shorts. Just, nope, wasn't going near them. Wasn't going up there at all, nothing. So it falls to the eldest son, the great hunter, to take care of this rodent problem. And I set a glue trap under the hole behind the toilet. We caught the mouse, but the problem is now you've got a live mouse struggling to escape from a glue trap. And that's not fun. It's not humane. It's not. I think it's more humane with the old school traps where just the bar comes down before the mice knows what hit it. It's over. Everybody's happy. But I still freak out.
Well, I don't know if the mouse is happy. But,
well,
yeah.
But does the mouse know? And is a mouse capable of happiness or sadness? You know, it's a mouse. All right. Point taken. Your Honor, I will allow that. I'm happy, and it's quick, but I still freak out having to pick up the mousetrap with the dead mouse on it, but not nearly as much as I had to when I had to pick up the glue trap with the mouse. Imagine, you know, four paws start, and he's pulling, and you see his little mouse face and the neck muscles just, and I'm like, dude, I'm sorry, but I wouldn't pick it up with my hands because I was afraid in one last super mouse strength moment, the mouse would rip itself away from the glue and attack me, which it would have been within its rights to do so. I have, you know, that's fine. You want to fight back. I'm up for that. So I took a ruler and I pressed the ruler. I'm as far out as my arm will go. My body is, you know, I don't want to be anywhere near this mouse. I press the ruler onto the glue pad, and I pick it up like a popsicle. Then I jam the whole thing into a plastic garbage bag and tie it up. Now, see, this is where now this mouse has got to suffocate, and it's going to take a while. But I take it out to the garbage can, and that's that. I would much rather, like I said, let's just do it up. So circle back to this rat that freaked me out at 5:15 a.m., Now I'm, you know, I'm trembling. I'm in a fetal position mentally, not physically. They would have called security from the building. It had me, you know, poked with a stick. So that was hopefully this morning. Now I parked at the same garage, and when I walked out, I was very cognizant of the area where the rat had come out last night. I'm not going to say that I was panicked, but I think you can tell by my demeanor that I am not fully calmed down yet. So no rat sighting on the way here. I'll let you know later if you'll get a text.
Good.
Because this morning, I almost texted you this morning. You know,
I know we have to break here in a second,
we
but
do.
When we get back, can you tell your possum story? That's one of my favorite stories.
The possum story.
Dealing with the possum by your garage.
Oh, my goodness. Another time when I showed my fearlessness. This is why Debbie stays with me, because I'm all man. You got some sort of wildlife problem, you send me out. The job will get done, but it's going to make for a floor show. It's going to be very, very crazy. All right, let's do this. And yeah, all right. It's all Request Wednesday. Brian Noonan in for Nick, WGN. All right. So I was regaling you with the story of the rat that... I'll say attacked me. That might be hyperbole, but it scared me. Well, that is the truth.
And it's karma.
You think?
Yeah, for that rat that you suffocated.
It was a mouse, first of all. And is it more that I suffocated it? Is that worse than if I just snapped its neck?
You left it. You left it to die.
Well, what was I going to do? Hit it with a hammer? I wasn't going to. I didn't want to. I'm not going to reach down and squeeze its little head till it pops. You know, they say, oh, these rat these glue traps are more humane. No, they're not. And I saw somebody, a friend of mine on Facebook, posted they have a rat problem. And there was some rat trap that will, once the rat is in there and caught and dead, it will send a message to your phone. Hey, the rat's dead. Oh, terrific. I'm out to dinner right now. I'll have to tend to that later.
You need a cat. That's what you need.
That's what somebody texted me. Get a cat. So I'm going to get a cat just for the few times a year that I have a mouse, or, you know.
How about a humane trap that doesn't involve glue, and then you can just bring it to the park forest or something?
Well, there's that.
Why would I take all my mice to Park Forest?
I meant Forest Preserve.
Oh, okay. But, anyway. I was like, wow, the people at Park Forest very upset with you right now, Dan. We don't need your mice in our town. Why do you pick out our town? For your spite. Why don't you get... Not in our backyard, pal. Maybe put the mice in your own town. I don't know. So you get one that you can catch and release. But where am I going to take... Where am I going to take a mouse to release it? Well, Park Forest.
Park Forest.
Obviously one.
Yeah, the Park Forest Chuck E. Cheese is a great place.
Oh, what if I did take them to Chuck E. Cheese and just let them out there? But now I got to transport a mouse. That's a lot of work. You know, there's a lot of mice. I don't think if I thin the herd a little bit, it's going to, you know, I don't relish the opportunity at all. But I will say this. I've never had to get more than one. It sends a message. This house is hardcore. You come in here, things won't end nicely.
You should have just left it outside, let it die as a message. Or maybe just chop its head off, a la Game of Thrones.
Like the VC, just put his head on a pike?
Yep.
Wow.
All those other rats, they'll know what's going on there.
That's even more gruesome than suffocating them in a garbage bag.
I like the 180 by Esmeralda. Like,
yeah.
Like, how dare you let that rat suffocate? But cut off its head and stick it on a pike in front of it.
Put it on a stick. Wow.
If you're going to go brutal with a message to the other rats.
I think quick and clean is the way to go.
I'm with Dan.
V, if you're listening, just don't piss her off.
How about it? This man.
I'm with Dan, though. Catch and release.
Okay, you guys are very, you know, Marlon Perkins. I understand that. Charlie Potter, very excited about your mentality. Maybe Steve Dale would also applaud that kind of thought. I'm not going to take them somewhere and release them. I figure, just like any other trespasser, you come in my house, you got trouble. Trouble, trouble, trouble. I don't think we're going to have time to tell the possum story.
Oh, man.
Except for, how much time we got? We got like a minute.
A minute and a half, yeah.
How can I tell a story in a minute and a half? Other than the fact that I chased this possum under a wheelbarrow, and it was looking at me with its beady red possum eyes, and its possum teeth, and I'm scared of all wildlife. Let's be honest. This possum, this possum was looking at me like it heard about what happened to the mice and was there for payback for everybody. So I have a rake now, and I'm trying to move the wheelbarrow because I know the possum's under there and flip it up. And now the possum scurries out, but then it plays dead. It plays possum. And I'm like, isn't this wild? A saying come to life right in my backyard. So now I'm not going to whack the possum with the rake. I'm just kind of, I'm poking it just a little bit, just a little bit of possum and hoping he'll get up and leave. Well, he was upset. I'll put it that way. The possum didn't like being poked by a rake handle. And have you ever heard I had a possum hiss at you? It's not nice.
No.
I've had women angry at me and they've hissed at me. I could take that. I've had my dogs bark at me. I've had children cry and vomit on me. All that fine. Nothing equates to a possum hissing at you. Because you know, there's no reasoning with an angry possum. That thing's going to go from playing dead to latched onto your throat. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing. So, to end the story, after I poked him a few times, he wised up. And he scurried out under the fence. And then the next night I saw him across the alley hanging out over there. He learned. They all have to learn a lesson. A lot of lessons learned here. It's Brian Noonan for Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Yellowstone National Park is the oldest national park in America, founded in 1872. It's 2.2 million acres of some untouched wilderness, the home for unbelievable scenery, wildlife, everything else. This week on the National Geographic Channel, there is a four-part series called Yosemite Live. It is, if you haven't had a chance to see it, check it out. It is unbelievable. There are 34 live cameras set up throughout the park. There's people all over. It's just wonderful. And one of the men who has helped documenting all of this and who is flying around in a helicopter is the Emmy Award-winning TV cameraman, David Alan Arnold. He joins me now on WGN. David, thanks for staying up late. I appreciate it. Welcome.
Brian, God bless you. Thanks for having me on.
This is an unbelievable story. So we're going to get into all the deal with Yellowstone Live, which is just a fantastic program. But I got to ask how you got involved. How did this become your job? How did you become a helicopter cameraman?
Well, that's a hell of a question. So I started in television in a very unusual way. I began sweeping the floor 23 years ago.
Okay.
That was my first job. And I found out later in life that I had been actually hired because of my attitude. The bosses at the company thought, well, this kid doesn't know anything, but he shows up on time and he works hard.
Okay.
So let's give him a chance. And so my first job was sweeping the floor. And that was how I learned that if you do a good job sweeping the floor, they will let you do just about anything.
So, how do you go? All right,
yeah.
Sweeping the floor, they'll let you do anything. I get that. But did you have flying experience before? Because a lot of people go, well, I started out sweeping the floor in the mailroom, and then I moved up to something else. Rarely do you hear, I was sweeping the floor, now I'm flying a chopper around.
Yeah, that's a great point. No, I had no experience. And they told me when they hired me, they said, you know, we could hire someone from Hollywood or New York, but you seem hungry. Are you hungry? And I was hungry.
Yeah.
And I the one thing that I brought, you know, because I have a very high-tech occupation.
Yes.
The camera systems that I work with are gyro-stabilized. They're very sophisticated, complicated. They're difficult to learn how to use in certain ways. They're complex machines. But I came with no technical skills. The only thing that I brought with me into my, you know, the start of my career was hard work without complaint. And that was enough for them because I think they had been, you know, working for years with different guys. And I think they, unbeknownst to me, they were looking for somebody who just had a good attitude.
Okay.
And who could learn everything else. And that's, you know, I like to think that's what I've done over the past 23 years.
Well, it seems incredible to come in with no flight training and no technical skills for the camera. And then, as you say, over a 23-year career, not only are you an Emmy winner, you've worked on tons of movies and television shows and commercials, and now you're involved in this. Was it a long process for you to get to that point?
It was maddening. I knew so little about what I had to, the equipment that I had to work with in this line of work. It was just mind-boggling. I knew nothing about aircraft. I knew nothing about gyro-stabilized, computerized camera systems, which we had to repair a lot of times. You had to get a soldering iron out and get into the circuit boards and solder wires together just to make the camera to work so we could go out and shoot something like this. And it was a daunting challenge because I didn't have a background in it. I didn't have a college degree. And I really had to work very, very hard to learn how to use the equipment, how to repair it when it breaks, and how to just get through each show without having an equipment failure in the middle of, you know, like Yellowstone Live. You want the camera to work
definitely
for the entire live show, because it's a live show. If the camera craps out, you know, it's on live television. Everyone will see that.
Now, what was it? Do you remember the first job you had when they finally said, okay, David, your training seems good. You seem to know what you're doing. We're going to send you up. This is the first job. What was it?
I do remember the first show that I ever flew for in a helicopter was ABC News. And the ValuJet airline crash had just happened in South Florida.
Right.
And so I was hired to go build our gyro-stabilized camera on the helicopter and go fly over the Everglades and film the crash site.
Oh, man.
For news.
Now, when you're in the helicopter, is the camera run with remote control? Are you actually, you know, if it's gyro stabilized, it must be in some housing underneath. Is that what's the physical makeup of the setup?
You're exactly right. We have a gyro stabilized platform that sits outside the aircraft. It is a pod that is kind of a round spherical machine that inside has gyros and a set of motors. The computer senses every movement of the helicopter, which is, you know, moving in all three axes or all three directions.
Yeah.
It's rolling, it's tilting up and down, it's twisting. And the gyros sense that, and they move the platform inside in equal and opposite direction.
Okay.
And it causes the camera to sit perfectly still while the helicopter is moving violently around it. And that's how we hold a steady shot. And I never touch the camera. The camera is outside. I have a laptop controller, which kind of, in a way, it looks like a video game.
Okay.
And that sits on my lap. And when I want to tilt down, I don't grab the camera and tilt down. I push on a joystick, and the motors move the camera to tilt it down. But because I never touch it, therefore, I'm not introducing any shake into the picture.
It's amazing. All right, let's talk a little bit about Yellowstone Live, because it is, I watched episodes 2 and 3. I still have to watch the first episode, and then tomorrow is the final episode. It's amazing. One, the advent of high definition had to change your job. As a viewer, it's changed everything. I think had this show been on in standard def, it might not have been quite as visually exciting as it is right now. But is there a challenge for you when you and the pilot are going out into some of these really remote areas? Is it a different challenge than trying to fly over, like you said, the Everglades, which is, you know, remote, but you're still a little closer to civilization?
Oh, absolutely. It is to go into a vast wilderness where there are no roads, there are no police. There's no ambulances that can come and pick you up if you have a problem. There's just a bunch of bears and wolves that will eat you if you stop moving. And that's a little intimidating. So today we were flying on top of a mountain in Yellowstone, mm-hmm. and it was a beautiful scene. There was a herd of about 50 elk.
Yes.
And they're laying in the grass, and a short distance away was a grizzly bear. And he was, you know, stomping through the grass and swinging his head violently from side to side, like he's looking for something to eat. And you look at that, and I'm seeing this helicopter, and I have to think for just a minute. Well, I hope nothing bad happens to our helicopter, because I would not want to land next to that bear.
No, and after watching the second episode, where the bears don't like to share their food, so you and the pilot, they're not going to be very pleasant at all if you run into them. The shot of the elk was amazing because you're shooting as you said this herd of elk, and I forget the woman, the correspondent who was talking about them, was able to identify, oh, these are female elk, and you can tell because they don't have the antlers, and it's. Every aspect of this show is phenomenal. Besides that, what's been up to this point the most breathtaking? And you've seen a lot of stuff, but the most breathtaking thing in Yellowstone that you've filmed?
The most breathtaking, I would say, are the herds of bison. They are spectacular to look at. They look like something out of a science fiction movie.
Yeah.
And they really do look, to me, prehistoric. I mean, these are beasts, and some of them weigh more than your car.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you're also getting to see them in the pre-rutting. So they're rolling around, making all these big, the males are creating all this dust, and then they're chasing the females. It's hilarious.
It really is. When we fly over them, I just kind of stare at them in amazement. They're so massive, and they are, I mean, just imagine an animal the same size and weight of your car that would, if he saw you, he may just walk over and stomp you to death. And like almost automatically, and so just to be in the presence of such a powerful creature who may or may not kill you, depending on the mood he's in, it's kind of like running into bulls, honestly. It's just to see beasts that are so big and so angry and it's stunning, and they're considered the most dangerous animals in the park.
Really? More so than the bears? That surprises me a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's because of their behavior and it's because of their size and weight. So because they weigh so much and because they're so strong, they don't have to do much to hurt you. And they're just powerful. And would like to come and visit Yellowstone Park and see the beautiful sights and the animals. But it's a little humbling to be around such massive beasts that could so easily kill you if they looked at you the wrong way.
Yeah, it's amazing to watch. David Alan Arnold is the helicopter cameraman. He's the flying cameraman. He's covering this for Yellowstone Live, which is airing this week on the National Geographic Channel. If you haven't had a chance to watch it, the final episode's tomorrow, then you can watch the other episodes on demand. We'll talk to David a little more about not only about the Yellowstone Live project, but a very interesting part of your life that, as I was reading about you, I don't know how this came about, so I'm looking forward to hearing about it. DavidAlanArnold.com is the website to get all the information on David, his books, and all the amazing things he's done. We'll talk to David more in just a minute here on WGN. Brian Noonan in for Nick. My guest, David Alan Arnold, he's been a helicopter cameraman for 23 years. He's currently working on Yellowstone Live, which is airing this week on the National Geographic Channel. He's worked on Super Bowls. He's worked on tons of movies and television shows. A fascinating story. He's the author of a book, Help from Above, How I Went from Sweeping the Floor to Painting the Sky. There's a lot... You've got a lot of chapters in your life, David, that I want to try to touch on a lot of them. But let's talk a little bit more about Yellowstone Live. How logistically, with a park as big as Yellowstone, which I mentioned was 2.2 million acres, how many airborne cameras do they have? Because I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, Yellowstone doesn't allow drones to fly over the park. Is that correct?
That I'm not sure of, but it wouldn't surprise me. There are a lot of places that don't allow drones to overfly, especially in a place like Yellowstone where they're going to have a lot of visitors and tourists.
Right.
And I can understand how the rangers might feel about people, you know, pulling out cameras and then flying them over the crowd or potentially into the geysers, you know.
So how many airborne cameramen or camera people, I guess, are working on Yellowstone Live?
I'm it. That's,
you're that's, it?
We have one helicopter with our gyro-stabilized Cineflex camera on the front, and we have a second aircraft which picks up our pictures. So we fly all the way around the park and look at different animals and different geological features, geysers and boiling pools of water. And while we're doing that, there's an airplane that follows us around. And the airplane receives, we transmit our pictures to the airplane. The airplane transmits our pictures to ground stations. And then the ground stations send them over to the satellite truck.
It's an amazing process. How do they, and because it's live TV, you never really know, which is why, you know, as nobody's making any promises on this show. It's not like, hey, if you watch tonight, you're going to see, you're going to see this happen. How do the directors know where to send you? Or is it like, okay, we're hoping to see, like, for example, tonight, we're hoping to see the elk. How do they know to send you to the elk at this particular time?
Well, first of all, it's National Geographic,
sure,
and they're among the best in the world at what they do, and so they've had journalists and scientists working on this project for a long time to figure out, you know, what they want to show in the park, what's the best way to show it, and they put a lot of work over a long period of time to develop their stories and position crews in different parts of the park and then figure out how to get a live picture from a wilderness area.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like in Chicago, you could just, you know, step out of your van or your car and hook up plug in something to an outlet and, you know, transmit to another place. But in Yellowstone, it's there's nothing there. It's just
right.
Wilderness. So they've had to figure this out, how to engineer to get our pictures are traveling 60 miles.
That's
from the helicopter to get back to the satellite truck where the director is.
It is amazing. The visuals are just stunning, whether you're flying over, as you mentioned, herds of wildlife, or whether you're going into these canyons or over the geysers, or as the British host of the show calls them, geysers. Oh, this is one of the most national geysers. My wife and I were howling when he called them geysers. It's fun.
We laughed at that too.
The geysers. So
pretty funny.
When you're doing this, and maybe it hasn't happened so far in Yellowstone, hopefully, but I would imagine over a 23-year career, this job can have some danger to it. Whether it's something happening to the aircraft. What's the most dangerous situation you've been in?
Well, I do talk a lot in my book about some of the bad things that have happened over the years. I've lost a number of colleagues who were killed while doing what I do for a living. And it's definitely an adventure.
Okay.
And in writing Help From Above, I really, you know, had never thought about some of the reasons of why I do what I do. And in the process of telling the stories of the past 23 years, flying around the world to different places, some of which are very dangerous, I really started to understand a little bit of, why do I do this? Because this is a very dangerous job. And there's no guarantees. It's an adventure.
Do you consider yourself a daredevil or somebody who loves taking risks?
Well, I didn't set out to be that. I kind of stumbled into this line of work, and it's not like I dreamed of being a helicopter cameraman. I just wanted to work in the movie business.
Okay.
And so I knocked on a lot of doors as kind of a know-nothing kid. I just wanted to get started working in the entertainment field, and a door, and they said, okay, kid, come on in, you can do what we do.
And now you're 23 years later. You look back and go, wow, that's been quite a journey.
It's been a hell of a ride. It is dangerous, And I have lost friends, you know, who died while flying for TV shows or movies. I think as I started to write the stories in the book, I think I just kind of started to realize that the reality for me is it's not that I wake up every day and I go, oh, I got to go do something crazy and dangerous and get some adrenaline rush. But because my work is an adventure and because I don't know if I'm going to come home every day, I think it causes me to just naturally live more fully. Mm-hmm. And I think that the reality is we're all going to die.
Sure.
And I think it's something that we all think about every day. And I think, you know, for me, the challenge is not so much to think about when I'm going to die. It's more to think about how am I going to live today? If this is my last day, how do I live fully?
That's a good way for all of us to think. David Allen Arnold is my guest. David, can you stick around during the news? Because I have to ask you about covering Super Bowls and some other things and how you became a crime fighter, which is, to me, you know, just another chapter of your life. Can you stick around for a little bit?
I would love to. Thank you.
DavidAllenArnold.com is the website. The book is called Help From Above, How I Went From Sweeping the Floor to Painting the Sky. We'll talk more with David on the other side of the news, which comes your way after this on WGN. Good morning, Brian Noonan in for Nick DiGilio. Nick will be back next week. He is on vacation. We are talking with a fascinating man. David Allen Arnold is an Emmy Award-winning cameraman, a helicopter cameraman, flies around. He works on everything. This week, he is working in Yellowstone National Park as part of National Geographic's Yellowstone Live. Final episode airs tomorrow, but you can go back to, if you go to nationalgeographic.com, you can watch the past episodes, and it is visually just stunning to see. David, thanks for sticking around, because as I mentioned, talking about Yellowstone Live is very exciting, and that's what's happening now. But talking about your book, Help From Above, How I Went From Sweeping the Floor to Painting the Sky, as I was reading about you, you know, first I'm reading about all the different things you've worked on, and I want to add, is there a difference between, because you've worked on the Super Bowl, you've worked on the World Series, is there a different challenge covering a sporting event than, say, when you've worked on The Amazing Race or Deadliest Catch?
Yeah, it's every show is a unique challenge. And by the way, not only have I done World Series, I did the World Series in 2016 in Chicago.
Oh, okay. So you've flown past us.
Whew, that was something else. I've done 1,000 sporting events in my career. I've never looked down on a baseball stadium 2 hours after the game, and the entire stadium is still packed with people who are so excited after game 5 that they had won and the Cubs were still in it.
It sounds strange, but can you, from as high up as you are, as you're looking down, you know, you're used to framing things and getting emotion through a picture. Can you sometimes feel the energy, like when you were looking down on Wrigley Field, you're seeing it, but does how you're seeing it and the emotion that's coming through change how you're shooting it?
Oh, it was, I'll never be the same, honestly. To witness something like that was so spectacular. It was such an uplifting story to see, you know, the team rally to stay in the World Series and keep hope alive for the entire city.
Yeah.
They had an army of police lined up around the stadium to keep order after the game. And so you look at this massive line of men and women in police uniforms who are all, you know, ready to, you know, calm the crowd or whatever they have to do to keep things, you know, maintain law and order after the game. And I mean, just the spirit of the entire city just focused on that one event.
Yeah.
And the fact that they hung in there and they did what they had to do to win. And basically, the entire stadium remained packed for hours after the game. I've never seen that before. And when the people did finally come out, they were basically high-fiving the cops on their way out of the stadium. I mean, everybody was just so ecstatic and so excited. And I mean, just it was just such a powerful moment of, you know, human triumph of, hey, we were down and it probably wasn't going to work for us, but we made it happen and we're all together in this. And I mean, it was just such an incredible bond of all of those people, you know, and the W is flying around the city. I'm at 1,000 feet, so I can see the whole city.
Yeah.
And the W is everywhere. Like everyone in the city is thinking about the same thing. It was just such a shared experience that, you know, I really don't think you can witness something like that and be the same person after.
That's very cool. And you're right. If you're a cameraman working down in the ballpark or on the street, you're getting a much smaller, narrow perspective. But as you said, at 1,000 feet, you've got the whole city, the whole picture laid out in front of you. It's got to be just magnificent.
Well, Chicago is one of my favorite cities to fly in, and it's a beautiful city from the air, absolutely one of a kind. And to see the whole city come together for a thing like the World Series and the Cubs was it was just awe-inspiring. And as long as I live, I'll never forget that game.
That's very cool. It's cool that it happened right in our backyard. All right, I have to ask, because as I'm reading about you and reading about the book, Help from Above, How I Went from Sweeping the Floor to Painting the Sky, somehow, and you'll explain to us how, you got involved helping a town get rid of organized crime. Tell this story, because it's amazing.
Yes, I did. Book number 2 comes out, I'm aiming for September release on Amazon.
Okay.
And I tell the story of why I'm writing books, because in 23 years of filming for TV shows and movies, I never told anyone what I do at work. I never told the story of the World Series in Chicago. I never told the story of flying over New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina.
Oh, that had to be awful.
It was awful. But I never said a word to anyone. I mean, I've had so many adventures around the world. You know, spectacular, you know, triumphs and working on big Hollywood movies, but also really scary episodes where I may not have used the best judgment and I almost didn't come home. And I never talked about it. And so I just, you know, lived my quiet life. When I came home from those adventures, I didn't say a word to anyone about where I had been or what I had been doing. And in 2013, something happened in my little town in California. And it was extremely dangerous. It was unbelievably illegal. And it went on for 4 years.
Oh, my God.
And it was at our school bus stop in our little town. And I was outraged. And I let it be known. And I would stand across the street from these guys when the kids were there. And you just have to picture a scene of like a biker gang.
Yeah.
At a bar. That's what it looked like.
Okay.
And these guys were there every day. They're running an illegal business. The whole thing was a scam. And I just couldn't accept it. I understand that corruption is the way of the world. You know, I'm not going to end that. But I just had a very strong feeling of, you know what? You don't do that here. You guys can have your crime and your corruption wherever you need to do that. But you don't do it where children gather 6 times a day to wait for a school bus. And so I never backed down, and I never quit fighting with them. And in 2014, we found a body behind their building that had been hidden there for 8 months.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that allowed us to get the hooks in to get them finally kicked out of the town. But the story is coming,
okay.
Because I don't want this to ever happen again to any town anywhere. And I think it's really important for people to learn day by day how it went and how it felt to deal with this. And if they ever have a problem like that in their town, you know, have some idea of what it's going to take to get rid of it.
What's been scarier, dealing with those guys or some of the adventures you've had in the air?
Definitely. They're both scary in different ways.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
And I had plenty of near-death experiences in the air. So I wouldn't say I'm comfortable with it, but it's definitely a part of my job. And, you know, and I'm very honest in book 1, Help from Above, about my shortcomings and about how I struggle sometimes with simple tasks that are very easy for most people. And I think that it's a very important part of my story is to not only tell the story of my adventures and the risks I've taken, but also to be honest about the mistakes I've made. And because I think if anything is going to give people hope or comfort in the idea that they could do a difficult thing, or they could get a job of their dreams, or they could stand up to bad guys who are backed by the police. I think if anything would encourage them, it's by learning about my flaws and the times where I made mistake after mistake, but just kept going and you know, got to where I wanted to be.
It's an inspiring story. And before I let you go, David, I just want to ask you, because you have a documentary coming out, too, about the skies above when you were working on The Deadliest Catch. You watch The Deadliest Catch, at, you know, sitting in your living room, and you think, boy, how do these guys deal with it on these boats because the storms are so intense? How rough was it in the sky trying to film during these weather episodes?
It was unbelievably scary. We've had, in 14 years of Deadliest Catch, we have had such adventures. And some of those stories are in Help From Above, my first book.
Right.
And there's a story in the end of the book, which happened about 2 years ago. A journalist called me and he said, Dave, I want to come up and fly with you on Deadliest Catch. And I want to, you know, take pictures and tell the story of what you do up there. And I said, okay, no problem. We're going to have to take you to a Coast Guard facility and trap you inside a helicopter fuselage, flip it upside down and submerge it in a pool.
Oh,
so you can practice getting out of it. And he said, I got to do what? And
wow.
I explained to him how dangerous it is up there and the type of training that we have to go through just to, you know, be reasonably safe to go and do it.
Oh.
And I could just hear the enthusiasm draining out of his voice, kind of like you're doing right now.
Yeah, no, that's...
And he's hearing all this and he said, you know what? I don't think I want to go. And so now we're just sitting on the phone. There's kind of an awkward silence.
Right.
And he says, why do you do it? And I thought about that. And I kind of realized as we're having this conversation, that's actually a really good question.
Yeah. What did you tell him? Why do you do it?
I told him, I said, I think humans are made for adventure. We, you know, myself included, we all spend so much time and energy removing every form of risk. How do we buy just the right house without taking a risk? How do we get just the job that we want to have without any risk? Or, you know, how do we make ourselves, you know, we live in a gated community. How do we make ourselves completely safe at all times? And we spend so much time and energy doing that, that it's very easy to forget that human beings are built for adventure. We're not made to play it safe all the time. You know, it feels good to be safe. I like it, just like anyone.
Yeah.
But the reality is there's a part of our spirit that yearns for adventure and for a risk and danger and for going on a meaningful quest.
Well,
and so I think that's an important part of life. And I do think that through my work, I've found a path that gets me in touch with that. So I always tell people, I said, don't worry about me. You know, if I'm killed tomorrow, I guarantee you this, I am living fully.
It's amazing. And if you want to see some of David's work, you can tune into National Geographic Channel for Yellowstone Live. The final episode is tomorrow night. DavidAllenArnold.com is David's website. You can pick up his book, Help From Above. When's the documentary coming out?
Documentary is to be determined.
Okay.
The gangsters threatened lawsuits.
Ah,
and
well, sure.
So
why would they?
The Hollywood producers had to kind of put things on hold
because they couldn't
risk being sued. However, I have taken the burden myself to put the story on record.
Very nice.
Will be the second book comes out in September, and I will tell the whole story, start to finish, what happened at that school bus stop, And that will free up the producers, because once I put the story on record, there's really no one you can sue to keep it quiet.
Very nice. Well, I hope we can talk to you then when the second book comes out. David, it has been a treat. Thank you so much for your time this morning. And again, everybody go check out Yellowstone Live on the National Geographic Channel and David's website, davidallenarnold.com. It was a pleasure. I look forward to talking to you again, David.
Brian, thank you so much. And by the way, I enjoy your tweets. You're a very funny guy.
Oh, thanks very much. I appreciate that. We'll talk to you again soon. That's David Allen Arnold. DavidAllenArnold.com is where you can get all his information. And just the list of movies and TVs and commercials and everything he's worked on is amazing. But do yourself a favor. If you like nature at all, if you've never been to Yellowstone, or even if you have been to Yellowstone, check out this show, because it's just... it's interesting, but it's visually just gorgeous. They have cameras all over the park, and it is just a treat to watch. All right, let's do this, and then we'll do more. It's WGN. Dun, 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 dun. That was a fascinating story. I had to tell you. I love those kind of stories. Can you imagine? Guy starts by sweeping the floor. And now he's won Emmys, he's flying all over the world, he's fighting gangsters, watching buffalo rut. That's the coolest part, watching these bison. Because this is, well, it's nature. I'm not saying this to be provocative. They pee, and then they get, so they can get some mud, and then they get the dirt all going, so the musk is supposed to then attract the ladies. Now, I tried that once back at a music festival. Did not work. Man, oh man. You know what it attracted? Law enforcement. That's what it attracted. There was nothing. Esmeralda, if V tried to, you know, create a dust storm with his musk, would that, would you flee, as I saw some female bison doing?
Right, or
would,
but musk, a.k.a. pee.
Well, dirt, pee, pheromones, you know, bison sweat.
Well, yeah, I'm good.
You're good with that? All right.
No, thank you.
Yeah, this one, it was hilarious because there was one bison who was like protecting the female, a female, and then this male started the one, and they even said this, oh, that female is not at all impressed with his. And so this bison is like chasing a female down, like, hey, come on, give a brother a chance. It was really funny and all in high def. It was terrific. A programming note. Can we give a quick programming note? Sure. I was supposed to be here all week for Nick, which I have been looking forward to. Now, I'm not going to be here tomorrow. I will not be here tomorrow because Thursday, I've actually been cast in a television program, Esmeralda.
Oh, my.
Oh, that's right.
Superstar.
Well, sure. I'm doing an NBC episodic. And you know how they say there's no small parts, only small actors? That's not true. There are. I am a very large actor, and there are small parts. But it is a people. You know, I told some people that I got this, and it's exciting. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm happy to be doing it, but it's the weirdest process to get cast in anything, whether it's a commercial, a TV show, a film, whatever it is. And I, you know, when I was living in LA and much heavier, I did a few different things. I did some sitcoms and I did some commercials. But since I've lost the weight, I haven't been cast in anything. I've been very, very close, because it's a process. You get, you know, my agent has my headshots, and they work hard with the casting people submitting me. And when the casting person sees, you know, sees that you fit a certain part, the breakdowns come out, and they say, we're looking for this character. He is a man, 45 to 60. He is blah, 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 blah. And the casting director looks at your picture and looks at your resume and goes, yeah, all right, let's bring this guy in. So you go in, and auditioning, I don't care. And Nick's talked to a million actors, and I'm sure they all say the same thing. Auditioning is awful, because you're waiting in this room with a bunch of people who look just like you. No matter how unique you are, I guarantee you, if you go to a casting session, there's a million people like you. When I first got to L.A., I thought, well, I'm a fat Midwestern guy. I am the most unique creature on the planet. Then I go to my first audition, there's 57 fat guys. And we all look the same. Maybe our hair is a little different. But basically, it's a bunch of sweaty, jowly, round guys. And I'm like, boy, I'm not that special at all. I'm just another guy. So you go, you're in this waiting room. And nobody, you know, you may exchange some pleasantries if you know another person, but there's not a lot of camaraderie or chit-chatty because, let's be honest, we're all going for the same thing. And you may be my friend, but that's my car payment, you know? So it's, there's that kind of edge. It's that, not fake niceness, but very, you know, arm's length niceness. Then they call you in to this room. And, I'll tell the rest of the story, the whole process on the other side. Because we have to do this, then it's news time, so we'll do this first. Hey, it's Brian Noonan in for Nick DiGilio. That's right. Here all week, except for tomorrow. I was going to be here tomorrow. We had things all lined up. We had guests already. We're going to move some of them to Saturday. Mark Carman will be here with you tomorrow because I, as I mentioned before, I got cast in a TV show. And that sounds glamorous, and it's, you know, it's cool. I'm not going to lie. I called Debbie when I got the news today, so I wake up. This is a nice way to wake up after getting home, after being terrified by a rat. Then I get home, I go to bed, I wake up, and I get this news from my agent. Hey, guess what? You booked this part, which is very nice. But immediately, you know, here's a glimpse inside the bat hotel that is my head. I'm like, oh no, I gotta quick call the boss and see if I can tell her I can't work tomorrow night on Nick's show. Then I gotta do this and this. Instead of taking a minute and just being grateful and being excited, I immediately start looking at all the things that are gonna make this a hassle. And then I start to downplay it a little bit, you know, because it's not a big part. It's nice. It's great. But I was talking about the audition process because, as I mentioned, I know Nick has talked to people. And Nick, you know, Nick, having been a director, has had to sit in and audition people. And it's just a dehumanizing process. And I know everybody's going, boo-hoo, you chose. Yeah, I know. It's not like going out and breaking rocks for a living. But imagine walking into a room filled with strangers and them judging you immediately, whether you're good enough or not, based sometimes solely on your looks, sometimes on your looks and how you deliver said lines. You never know what they're judging you for. So the process is usually you get called into audition, and you walk in, as I mentioned, you walk into this room, and there's usually a casting assistant running the video camera. There's a casting person who is going to read the lines with you. You know, so you don't have to look like a lunatic and just do one side of a conversation. That's right, Bob, and that's what I told her. What do you mean I need to get off my horse? This just would sound dumb. Plus, you don't have, you don't want to dress like you're in a costume, but you want to dress to kind of give the idea of the part you're playing. You don't have props. It's a whole crazy deal. So you do the audition. Then, if you're lucky enough, you get a call back. And that means they cut some of the folks, and they've got, you know, now it's a smaller pool. So they're going to judge you a second time. So now, usually you go in for the callback, and this time the casting director might be there. You know, the first time it might have been their assistant or somebody. Now it's the casting director. So you do the same thing over again. Do you wear the same clothes? Oh, yeah, you do, because you have to remember what you wore. And sometimes the callback isn't for a week, so you better make sure you didn't get a haircut. You better, you know, it's like until you realize you're not getting that callback, you've got to keep everything the same.
Right, because I had heard an old acting story is that, male actors will all usually keep a beard, because if the part calls for a beard,
right,
you need to have a beard. And so, you know, and then if you get a part that requires you not to have a beard, you can just shave it, whereas you can't regrow a beard in, you know, 2 hours.
Can't regrow a beard, you can't regrow your hair. So here's how crazy I am. This is a sidebar to the story. Last week I get called in for this. Well, I bypassed the first two steps. So now I'm just going to the final step is when they call you in for producers. So at this step, you walk in and there's the camera person, there's the person who's going to read with you, there's the casting director, there's a producer for the show, and then there's the director. Sometimes there's a couple producers. I've walked in where there have been like two banquet tables, all with people. Now you're standing, it's You know when they come into American Idol and the three judges are sitting there? Multiply that by two or sometimes three. And all these people are staring at you and you're in this room. And now sometimes the director will ask you a question or the producer will ask you something or the director will give you a little, you know, okay, when you do it, try to do it like this. So you do your thing. And, you know, some auditions are a little longer than others because you might have some more lines. You're doing a whole scene. And you do it. And then you wait for a beat, and they always say the same thing. That was great. That was great. And sometimes they'll say, can you do it this way? Try it a different way. And I'm always thinking, oh, now they want to see if I can take direction. Sure, I can. I can do it however you want. So you do it again, and this is where it gets confusing. Because sometimes they'll be like, that was fantastic. And they're so effusive with their praise, and you think to yourself, man, oh, man. Clear a space on the bookshelf. The Emmy is coming. This is going to be fantastic. I can't wait. I'm going to have a big trailer, and I'm going to start making unreasonable demands. You know, my roast beef has to have no pink in it. I need just green M&Ms. I need small people to follow me around with fans. All of these things that I have dreamt when I finally get to that point I could be, that's all running through your mind until you don't get the part. Then you realize that. So after that, then you're at the point where you either hear something or you don't. And by hear something, they do what they call put you on avails. So my agent calls me, and says, all right, you're on avails. They want to know if you have any conflicts of the shoot dates. Oh, no. You always say no, even if you do have a conflict. Like, technically, I was working the next couple nights. So technically, that's a conflict. But also, it's overnight, so it wasn't really a conflict. Plus, I never, you know, do you ever really think you're going to get the part? Nah, yeah, not really. Only because history tells you that every time you think you've got something, it doesn't come. As an example of that, last May, I go in for another NBC episodic. This was for a big part. This was for a recurring part. And I was like, ooh, but I'm teaching second grade at this point. So I'm like, oh, no, what am I going to do? Well, I talk to the office. Long story short, I leave for about an hour and a half. I go and I audition. By the time I get back to school, you got a call back. It's tomorrow. Oh, no, I talk to the office again. I got to go to this. That's oh, they're so excited. Yes, go. I go. I do the callback. Now, this callback was with producers and everybody. And again, this is for a big part. I'm like, oh, man, this is it. This is it. Find me the guys with the fans because it's all happening now. I get back. By the time I get back to school, I have an email. You're on avails. I'm like, oh, this is it, Dan. This is you'll never see me again. You'll see me. You know where you'll see me? Behind a phalanx of security. That's the only way you're going to see me. And I did say phalanx. This is a Thursday. The show is supposed to start shooting the next Thursday. On Monday, I get a call from my agent. They want to know if you can start a day early. You bet! Of course I can. I'd be a fool to say no. So I tell them, sure, I can start a day early. You think at that point I have the part, don't you? Sure you do. Any rational human being would think you had the part. They've asked if you could start a day early. Why would they ask if you could start a day early if they weren't going to hire you? That's a question I'm still trying to figure out. Didn't get that part. I call my agent. You know, it's Thursday now. And I'm like, hey, what's going on? Oh, didn't we tell you they released you? No, you didn't tell me. Thanks. Have a good day. Click. Go to the mirror. Look at yourself. Fill yourself with self-loathing. Move on. Anyway, that didn't happen this time. So I go on avails. And I get the call and the email today that I get this part. And now tomorrow I go and I do my, you know, I get an email from the costume person this afternoon. Hey, give us all these sizes. What's your height? What's your weight? What's your sign? You know, preference in footwear, all this stuff. So I give them all the information and tomorrow I go in and they fit me for, costumes. And I don't know what the costume's going to be. I'm supposed to be this, Irish crony of a dead guy giving a toast at a memorial service.
Like a new Irish?
Well,
or
like
an old-timey Irish?
Well, not like 1840s Irish, yeah. Like current-day Irish.
I'm thinking like you wear one of those hats. You have a vest on.
Sure, a leprechaun suit. I've stated on a pot of gold. Woo, it's fantastic. I can't believe it. Let's raise a glass. I didn't have to do an accent at the audition, but obviously I could have. If they were looking for an oversized leprechaun that was going to do the part, I would have been the man for the job. So yeah, so I'm doing that tomorrow, getting my fitting, and then Thursday I'll shoot the thing, and then Thursday night when I come in here, Friday morning I'll tell you how it went. It should be fun. You know,
and now we had mentioned your name on Nick's show a week or two ago because we were talking about game shows, and
yes,
you appeared on Greed. So what are some of your other screen credits? Where have you?
Malcolm in the Middle, short-lived sitcom called The In-Laws. Tonight Show a couple times, Greed, Russian Roulette, another game show, actually three game shows.
Wait, Tonight Show?
The Tonight Show with Jay Leno?
Right, but what were you doing?
I was on there twice doing sketches.
Oh,
yes.
Fun.
Oh, my goodness, sure. Once was here when they taped at the Rosemont Theater. I did a sketch there. And then once was in Los Angeles where I had to be topless. That's not a look. But, you know, it's always funny when fat guys don't have shirts on.
Right.
That's hilarious.
Comedy gold.
Sure. Actually, in The In-Laws. No, that was It's All Relative. Was when I had to take my shirt off. That was the short-lived Lenny Clark sitcom. I was on a lot of short-lived sitcoms, Dan.
A lot of nudity, too.
Listen, I am not afraid. I'll work adult if I need to. I got to pay the bills, you know? I say no groinal. Nothing below the belt.
Is that the industry term, no groinal?
Well, that's my term. And my agent goes, that's not a thing.
It's the thing you circle. Groinal, no groinal.
Groinal, no groinal. You have to put these things down. You have to, Esmeralda, you know, you got to draw a line.
Yeah,
you have to have standards.
Although you have no line.
Well, I have tan lines,
yeah,
but only waist up. Right. If
you went no groinal, you would not have.
If I went no groinal, you know, first of all,
you would have to have upkeep in the sense of like you probably have to tan yourself,
tan, groom
fully, you wouldn't have tan lines.
Sure, a lot of waxing,
sure,
hedge clipping, weed whacking. There'd be
so one of the things is that one of the jobs you shouldn't do yourself.
Well, probably no weed whacking. You should do yourself. Well, that weed whacking, I'm not going to hire anybody to do my personal gardening. My personal gardening is just for me. That's I'm the only one who treads in that hedgerow. You know what I'm saying? I just keep everything nice.
Now, did anybody did your yes? agents or anything, like when you lost weight, were they like, oh, this is going to be terrible?
No.
We need fat guys.
No, there's, trust me, there's plenty of fat guys.
Oh, really? They weren't like, this is going to not go well
No,
for
they
you.
Actually said, oh, good, now you can wear a uniform, you could be a cop, you could be this, you could be, it opened up a whole world of rejection for me. I was used to being rejected in a very small niche, you know, fat jovial guy or fat angry guy. You know, that was my stock in trade of rejection. Now, I could be rejected as a dad, a cop, you know, some sort of agent, an angry politician, some sort of bureaucrat. I've got, oh man, there's tons of things I can be rejected for now. It's fantastic. And you know, plus I have to make sure I have all my lines memorized because I never go in with my glasses on. I've been told it changes how I look. I look much meaner, they say, and more stern without my glasses.
Ooh, this is also some big money because you have lines.
Sure. Oh, yeah. I'm speaking in my regular voice. I might throw a little English on it. Not English accent, right, but just a little something.
Are you here? Is it set in Chicago?
Yes, it's one of the NBC episodics that may or may not have a Chicago in its name.
Oh, I only mean because then you can throw a little that Chicago South Side,
yeah,
Irish accent in there.
I'm gonna have some plans when I go in. But I also don't want to be that guy who has like a couple lines and all of a sudden becomes this high maintenance jerk.
Listen, just like go stand in the corner and say that one line.
This is my method. What's my motivation for this scene? Your motivation is you're getting paid. Exactly. How do I do it? How you want me to say it? I talked to a friend of mine who's been in a lot of different things a while ago, and I was like, hey, do you think I should take some classes, you know, for these auditions? He goes, what stuff are you auditioning for? He goes, are you auditioning for all these shows? Blah, 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 blah. I go, yeah. He goes, he goes, can you memorize two lines and say it the same way three or four times? I go, yeah. Then you don't need a class. I was like, all right. Fantastic.
Now, do you think your experience giving toasts during Tony and Tina's wedding led to you being able to give a toast now at a funeral?
I think the fact that I've held more beers probably than anybody in that audition room helped me. I think the fact that as I looked at the other guys who were going out for this same part, because you sign in and I see who's going up and I'm like, you know, I might have looked more cronyish than some of the other guys. They were also auditioning a priest role, and I walked in and you could tell I could have had these three guys walk in and go, what part do you think these guys are auditioning for? And I guarantee both you and Esmeralda would have said priest. It was like, boy, how do you pick? Boy, all these guys look phenomenally like priests, you know? Whereas some of the other parts, you go, I don't know, maybe that guy could, you know, pull that off. There was no doubt with the priests. None. Like, holy cow. This is going to be crazy. So, I, you know, who knows what they, who knows? Who knows why this time, you know? And thankfully, I'm talking about it at, you know, 2:50, where I'm sure they're asleep. And since I haven't said the name, I'll say the name of the show after I actually tape it.
Yeah, we'll have to watch you.
Yeah, well, don't miss the beginning, because this my scene is, you know how they do the scene before the opening credits, the teaser scene they call it. That's I'm in that.
Oh, and then and that's the thing that's like, oh, what?
Right,
and
it hooks you in,
and then they do the titles.
That's right.
So like in Law and Order when they find the body.
Exactly.
Oh, it's the best part.
So that's I'm hooking you early, and then you know I'm done. So.
And about how long will we have to wait for this episode?
Well, I think this is episode 3 or 4 of the season, so it should, I would say, early fall.
Very nice.
Maybe a nice Halloween time, something like that. I'm not sure when the season will premiere. I'll find out.
You're in good company, because Patty's done it. Her friend, comedian Paul Farvar, has done an episodic.
Okay. Very nice. Yeah, they cast a lot of people. Yeah. The thing is now, I found out that once you're on one, you got to wait a couple seasons to do another. So they don't, you know, if say you're on Chicago Fire, next week I can't audition for Chicago PD or Chicago Med. I'm out. I'm out of the mix for a while. But that's all right. There's a lot of work in Chicago, and I'm busy here. All right, we have so many things to do. But Dan, you wanted this story. I
that was fascinating.
I think it's exciting.
Well, thank you, Esmeralda. It is kind of exciting. It is, you know, it'll be...
Listen. I have more questions after the break.
All right, well, we'll get to those questions then after this. All right, you have inquiries, you have questions, you have an interrogation that you want to conduct?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Two, possibly three questions, but the first one. A good friend of mine, Joe Kilgallen, was a comedian here in town. He's actually my neighbor.
Okay.
He's a comedian, and he was on an episode of Chicago Med. He played a victim of a stabbing during a pool game. A pool game got out of hand, and he got stabbed. And it just so happened that the hospital lost power that day as well. So,
oh, no.
Yes. Have you ever had to deal with, like, makeup or anything, like, along those lines? Because I've heard that's pretty hairy. And then also just, like, what's the experience like? Is it really, like, hours and hours for, like, a two-minute scene? Or is it because it's one of these hour-long episodics that are like, let's go?
Well, the episode... The episode is scheduled to shoot for 7 days. So they're starting on Thursday with one or two scenes, and they will shoot in different on different stages. We're at an outdoor location. So my scene is taking place in a backyard, supposedly in Canaryville. So we're off site. The rest of the show is shot on the sound stages at Cinescape, which is an unbelievable facility over at like 17th and Western, right by the Lagunitas Brewery. There's all the sound stages over there. So the worst experience I had was shooting a Prestone commercial in California when it was about 100 degrees. And I had to wear, I was a mob tough, fat guy mob tough. And I was in a black shirt, black tie, black suit in 100 degree heat. And we were out there all day. I shot a number of, there were like three commercials in this series that I shot. So we're outside and it's just hot. And, you know, I love the fact I had a woman whose entire job was to come over and mop my brow. That was her purpose in life, was to keep perspiration off my head. I felt awful for her. And yet I felt entitled that I should have a woman who's going to mop my brow. I'm in show business. That's what people in show business do. They have people do things for them that they don't want to do for themselves. Grocery shop, mop their brow, etc. Then the second commercial for that series was out in the high desert, outside north of Los Angeles, out in the desert. Again, 100 degrees, but that time I had to learn to stunt drive. We had an old Lincoln Continental with the suicide doors, you know? And part of the deal was I was supposed to drive up really fast, slam on the brakes, and hop out of this car. They said, "Do you know how to drive?" I said, "Well, yeah, I know how to drive. But I don't know how to drive and stop when there is a cameraman literally kneeling in the road." And I'm like, "Oh, my God, I don't know how they let this happen." Because I'm not a certified stunt driver, but afterwards they said, "You know, you should put stunt driver on your resume now." I'm like, "Oh, sure, I'm a stunt driver. Me and Burt Reynolds." So I would have to zip up, and thank God I did not kill that guy. Makeup is never a big concern for me, because I'm not, you know, a glamour puss, and I haven't done a zombie movie yet. And I don't foresee a lot of makeup for this thing either. I don't lose an appendage. There's no, no bodily injury to me, but that's that.
Maybe right. Next episode.
Yeah, let's hope. I'm really hoping that I have to, one of those 5 hours in makeup stories that I can talk about where I had to breathe through a straw. All right, we've got to do the news. We'll do it after this. WGN. Brian Noonan in for Nick DiGilio on WGN. Nick will be back next week. He is enjoying a fine vacation, and he'll come back rested and ready to rock you next Monday morning, right? Yep. All right, it's summer. You're sitting out in your backyard. You're looking at your house. You're thinking, "Oh, there's all these projects. I got to do this and that, and I don't know." And some people love it. I actually love doing yard work. But other things I do not enjoy when it comes to house kind of chores. But in the summer, there's some that you can do by yourself, or you should do by yourself as a cost-saving thing. They're not very hard. They're not very expensive. And some that you think, "Well, maybe I should do this myself," when no, you probably shouldn't. But I'm wondering, what's your Achilles heel when it comes to home repairs, when it comes to chores around the house? There's this one thing that you hate it. You don't want to do it, and you would pay anybody any amount of money to take it off your hands. 312-981-7200. Everybody's got one. For me, thank God my wife does it. For me, it's cleaning the bathroom. I will do anything else in the house. I do the laundry. I'll dust. I'll vacuum. I do the dishes. Whatever it is, I'll do it. Outside, I do all the yard work, all that. I do not like cleaning the bathroom. And so my wife does it and complains to me all the time, as I'm sure most men hear. "How do you get it under the seat?" I don't know. I don't know. But this was in the Trib, and I thought it could spur some conversation. So chores you can do yourself. Dan, you're a handy guy. You do a lot of the chores at home.
We do a rotation, which usually means I'm like, "Oh yeah, I'll do that," and then I forget, and then Eileen has to remind me that I'm supposed to be doing that. I'm trying to think of things that I refuse to do. I'm sure there's one or two, but for the most part, you know, like I'm in charge of the lawn. Which, like you, I actually take great satisfaction in.
Yes. I'm very upset with myself now because crabgrass seems to have taken over my front yard.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I'm going to have to put down some stuff.
Yeah. I don't worry so much about just as long. I'm more lawn. She's more garden, you know. Okay. So but it did bother me when I couldn't get the lawn for like a week just because things were so busy. And then I've got the dishes, we've heard before. V is awful at dish.
V doesn't wash the dishes?
No, he doesn't know how.
What do you mean?
He does a terrible job at it.
I'm gonna stop you right there, Esmeralda.
I have a follow-up story on this.
It's an unbelievable cop-out. I don't know how. I don't know how means
no, it's
I'm
not that he
lazy.
Doesn't know how. Well, he thinks he knows how.
He's a grown, intelligent man. How does he not know, even though he's from another planet, how does he not know how to wash a dish?
He thinks he does. You get hot, soapy
water, and you get the gunk
right.
off it.
He thinks he does, but then when I look at them, they'll be like grease, or he won't wash the bottom of it. And I'm just like, how is this clean? He's like, "It's clean to a point." I'm like, "That's not clean, man.
Wow. Clean to a point.
Yeah. He likes to just, his idea of cleaning now is rinsing things and then grouping them in the sink and then just leaving them there. And I'm like, cool. So right, I'm going to do this now. All
do you
right.
Not, no dishwasher at the...
We do.
Okay.
But then he puts them in, because we don't make that many dishes.
Sure.
We'll, you know, sometimes it's a couple days till we run the dishwasher.
Yeah. No, same at
and
our
I
house.
And I tell him, like, you have to rinse it off if you're not going to run it immediately because it's going to dry up and then the dishwasher is not going to be able to
right.
take it off. And he doesn't get that either.
Wow. That's not, you know what?
So I'm just like, stop touching the dishes. Just leave them.
And he wins. That's exactly, he did it and now he's the winner. He's conned you into thinking that he doesn't, it took him maybe a little longer than he had hoped. I can't believe I have to keep half-assing these dishes. And now finally, you've thrown up your hands in disgust and said, fine, I'll do it. And he's like, hey, of course you will.
Well, yeah, but then what am I going to do? I'm going to have half-greasy dishes.
Yes.
It'll be the worst.
No, you wash your dishes and make V eat off his trough-like dishes.
No, but it's also pots and pans and things
oh,
like that.
Oh, yeah, all right.
He won't wash them more than once, and I'm like,
what?
You kind of have to sometimes.
Oh, my goodness.
There's a whole thing. All he right. thinks my standard is very high, but I'm just like, it's just called clean.
Well, you sound demanding, but it's hygiene is key and health is fine. What if the health department dropped by your place?
Right. Yeah, and he works in a restaurant, so I'm just even
oh
like,
oh, my God. What? Not a restaurant?
Not in the kitchen, though.
Not in the kitchen, no. But still.
Does he wash his hands better than he washes the dishes? Because if he's bringing food to me, I don't want his dirty lizard paws touching
no,
my
does.
Eggs.
It's just, it's more like, don't you see how clean they do everything here?
Yeah.
Take that home. Take that idea home.
Oh, my goodness. All right. And Dan, you had a follow-up?
I did have a follow-up.
But now you've thought better of it?
Well, no. It was funny because I was, you know, you go on a YouTube hole every once in a while where you're watching one video and then you look at the next video, I was watching a video from Dawn about the proper way to wash dishes.
Ooh, Dawn the dishwashing liquid, not
yes.
Dawn some girl from
no.
Keokuk, Iowa.
The girl in the video might have been named Dawn, but I don't know that. So...
You didn't check?
I didn't check.
You didn't check her
right.
resume? There how is no, she qualified to tell you how to wash a dish?
Yeah, there's no commercial IMDb. I think there should be. I think that would be a good service.
That's oh, yeah.
But
anyway, so
stunt driver from the Prestone commercial in 1992, Brian
that's,
Noonan.
That's right. You can find that on YouTube.
Okay, anyway.
Sure, you can look
know.
That up.
So one thing I did learn from them, because I'm like, well, what am I going to learn about dishes that I don't already know? This video suggested that you start with the small objects and then go to the large. I had always started with the large and gone to the small.
Can I ask what the difference is? Dare I ask?
Well,
As I go into this dishwashing rabbit hole?
I think, and I don't know if it's that much cleaner, but, you know, if you're doing the silverware...
Yeah.
You know, to Esmeralda's point, you know, if I do the pots first, well, I'm putting the spaghetti sauce.
Well, sure, then you got to change the water.
In the water. But, like, I mean, I'm not going to refill an entire sink for five or six spoons at the bottom. I just rinse them off real good and then, you know, apply
them. I don't do it that way.
Oh, I always, pots and pans were always last. When I, pots and pans are always the last thing I wash.
I had always done pots and pans first, silverware last.
Oh, no, because then... Especially if you're using the thing of water,
mm-hmm.
it's greasier.
Right. Yeah. So the pots and pans have to wait till the end.
Right.
When I used to have to, because as a kid we didn't have a dishwasher. Like most people back then didn't have dishwashers. You know what the dishwasher was? Me.
Yeah.
And my brother. And we would have to alternate, and one would wash and one would dry, and two would complain. That was. So
from his room.
Yeah. So we would
there's
always,
a rat in here.
There's a rat. It's a rat covered in a Frito bag. He always just the Frito bag moved. You don't even have Fritos up there. Shut up. Get down here and dry the dishes. Silverware went in the bottom. You know, you fill the sink with the hot water and the soap. Silverware goes in the bottom so it can soak. So you get to, you know, if you have spaghetti or something, you got some cheese on the fork. You got to let it soak off. Do all that. Do the glasses first. So, because they're gonna hold the most grease, you do the glasses first, then you do the plates, then you do the silverware, then you do the pots and pans. That's, you know.
See, and I've never done that where I fill up the sink.
We used to have to do that. Now I just use, if I do stuff by hand, which drives Debbie crazy, because she'll occasionally tell me I don't do the dishes well, and I'll just say, I do.
Oh, me and your wife got stuff to talk about then.
Yeah, but see, she, you know, she'll complain if she sees, like on a measuring cup, if there's one like little thing, suddenly I don't know how to do the dishes. I'm like, really? For one speck of, you know, food stuff, my entire career washing dishes is coming under question. So we have one of those wands with the soap in it and the sponge, and I use that. Man, boom.
I fill up a little bowl, plastic, like Tupperware bowl.
Not the one you keep the cat in.
No, okay. That one's different. Just with some soap and then water, and then I have a sponge and I dip it.
Some of these jokes that we do, like Dad has done a couple callbacks, Esmeralda has, and I just, you have to listen all the time.
Yeah, that's the point.
You have to listen all the time. Right, exactly. If you want to be part of it, you got to listen. So you just fill up a little thing.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of my measure of how, because I don't have enough space to dry stuff.
Oh,
or
okay.
To put stuff, because I'd rather have it dried naturally than me using a towel.
Okay.
Because that, I think the towel gets all wet and it's just like, ugh.
Boy, and then it's full getting of bacteria, mad. Yeah.
That too.
Well, no, it's drying a clean dish, Dan. It's not.
Yeah, but they say that it starts to.
Well, sure, if it sits around. Well, the wash rag does, and the sponge that you know that stuff does. But if you're drying a clean dish with a clean towel, it's just water. It's not, you know.
Yeah, but you can. The same could be said for your body when you dry it with a towel. You gotta wash those.
Well, yeah, but not every time. Do you wash your towel every time you take a shower?
It's got to be like once a week, I think.
Yeah,
every
that's
few
what they
days.
Recommend. Does yeah. anybody do that? No.
But there's germs everywhere.
I go once a week
there's
on my shower towel. And people, I know there's germs everywhere. I'm completely covered in filth. But it, you know, it doesn't seem to bother me. I still walk around, you know. People got, I brought that up another time. Something about changing sheets or washing a towel. People got all, oh man. You would have thought I was spraying waste everywhere.
Oh, there, you're not doing it enough?
Yes. Oh, you only wash your towel once a week? What kind of animal are you? I don't know. What am I? I'm not. I'm using it to dry my clean body. I'm not, you know.
Yeah, but there's stuff. It adds up.
What the? Yeah. How often do you change your towel?
I mean, I'm really bad. Do it maybe once a week. All right. Maybe more.
No, once a week. That's fine.
I'm real lazy.
Dan, how often do you change your towel?
Yeah, I would say once a week.
See, we were in a bad habit when I was a kid, because there were so many of us, there weren't places to hang all these towels. So we would just, you know, we were going through towels like Fieldcrest was our sponsor. It was just, there was just, we were throwing towels all the time, and my mom could not keep up with all the towels. She needed like six washers and six dryers just to keep up with all the towels. Now, like I say, it's once a week I'll do the towels. You know, every couple of weeks I change the sheets. People lose their mind. You don't change your sheets every week? Do you change your sheets every week, Dan?
No.
No. No. Esmeralda?
No.
No, of course not. Nobody changes their sheets every week.
I look at them and I go, oh, we need to change these sheets. And then I go, yeah, whatever. And then we lay down.
Yeah. See, because changing sheets is a hassle. I don't care what you say. Now I'm trying to do it. Well, here they come. Towels should only be used to 2 to 3 showers.
I can understand that if you're like a construction worker and like.
Right, if there's a lot of
gunk
grit.
And like sweat and bison musk, but.
Or
you're
putting your towel in places musk, where it shouldn't really go. Yeah, if I'm rolling around during rutting season and, you know, that I come in and I'm covered with my own musky urine.
I've washed my face sometimes and then dried it, and there's still residue from maybe mascara or something that I wore, and I'm like, oh. So, yeah. I mean, the same could be said for your body.
Well, sure.
You're drying it. Maybe you just didn't get all of whatever is on you.
Yeah.
Oils and such.
All my oils and such. All my lubricated parts are, you know.
So you know what you just got to do? You just air dry.
Oh, sure. Walk
just
around.
Run through the apartment or through
just
your
home.
Let
God be your hair dryer.
Stand by a window.
Perfect. Get a fan. Walk out in the yard.
All you need is a bow tie.
That's it. Hello.
Yeah.
What are you doing? I'm drying, duh. What do you think I'm doing? All right, you know what else I'm doing? I'm taking a break, and then we'll talk. Well, maybe we'll get into these. Are there some chores that you don't, that you just will not do, that you will pay anybody to do? And if you want to weigh in on the towels and the sheets and tell us how disgusting we are, that, you know, you could do that too. All right, we started talking about chores that you should do yourself or outsource for the summer, but that's turned into things that we don't like to do, and it also turned into a tutorial on doing dishes and who can and can't do dishes, and that's how Chris, he wants to jump in on the dish conversation. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. What do you think?
Great show. I had a girlfriend who complained how I didn't do the dishes up to her standard.
Oh, like Esmeralda and V.
Yep, so I told her we'll go in the front, and I made a nice dinner for her. And when she came out, she had a paper plate with plastic fork and a plastic cup. And never complained again.
There you go. Oh, Esmeralda's shaking her head. It's not environmentally friendly, is it, Esmeralda?
Not at all.
No, not at all. But you proved your point, didn't you, Chris?
Absolutely. Point was taken.
Yeah, there you go. And then you can go back to the regular dishes. Perfect.
Yep. Have a great show.
Thanks. Thank you for the call. Yeah, it's... All right, Esmeralda, how do you feel about washing the back of the dishes?
You have to.
Do you?
Especially if you're piling them.
Uh-huh. Well,
you're
sure.
Stacking them one
sure,
on another.
Yeah. But does the back need to be as thoroughly cleaned as the front? I say no.
I mean, I don't think it usually needs to.
Right. But yeah, you can just run.
Naturally wouldn't be so dirty. So if
right.
you just run, I mean, you're not having to scrub it. I mean, if you have to scrub it, you scrub it.
Okay.
It's more on a, you know, case to case. Like, say, you put it on something dirty, then yes, you're going to have to take a look at it and scrub it down.
There you go. All right. I got a text from the 847. Not that it has to be done often, but I will pay for someone to wash my windows. Walls, too. No desire to do either. Somebody from the 815 says they do not want to fold clothes or iron clothes. I love to iron.
You like to iron?
I love to iron. For me, it is a very zen I iron this shirt for tonight. I iron. I love it. There's something very result orientated for me in ironing. I start with a very wrinkly shirt or pair of pants, and I take great pride when it's done that there's no wrinkles, everything, no wayward creases. Everything is perfect. It's kind of the one thing when I can focus.
Who taught you?
My mom. I watched my mom do it. She hated it. She hated ironing. And that's why it's funny. Most of our stuff as kids, you know, wasn't ironed. You'd take it out of the dryer or take it off the clothesline, which is a very outdated concept. Yes, I'm one of Laura Ingalls Wilder's kids. We took our clothes right off the clothesline. And you just put it on. And then as I got older, I would have to iron, you know, a dress shirt or something. And really, when I started doing stand-up, I would iron all my stuff before I went on stage. So, you know, she showed me once, and then I kind of perfected it. And now I've actually taught some of my friends how to iron because they were always like, well, your stuff looks so good. I don't know how to do this. Can you show me? I'm sure I can show you how to iron. Boom, boom, boom. And there you go.
I hate ironing.
Really?
My mom is like, I would always see her when I'd come home from school. She'd always be down in the basement ironing.
Yeah.
Watching her stories, ironing.
Ironing and watching her stories. Well, see, and some people, I mean, there were people, I remember, like, my grandma and stuff, they would iron their sheets, they would iron everything.
No, my mom used to iron my jeans.
Oh, really?
It was terrible. Like, mom,
oh, my goodness.
Stop.
Yeah.
That crease is not cool.
Oh, no. Yeah, you can't crease jeans. That's not, no.
She loved it. Yeah, she's like, what?
Wow.
Now they're nice and crisp. I'm like, no.
Oh, no, there's certain things I iron, certain things you don't, you just don't. Every once in a while, like, it depends. You just, but I love to do it. I love it. All right, well, here, I'll tell you, here's what they say you should pay to have somebody do. Pressure washing and tree trimming. There you go. This way I feel like I've, I teased something and we got to it. So if you're going to have something pressure washed, pay somebody to do it. And if you're going to have a tree trimmed, pay somebody because they know where to trim to keep the tree very healthy and alive.
See, power washing seems fun to me.
I did it once. It is terrific.
So why would you want someone else that would be like, yeah, because you really get results, right?
But you could damage things too. I remember doing a patio and all the grout just flying out because I was like, woo-hoo-hoo! Yeah, it's crazy. And then you have to rent the machine and you got to go pick it up. It's kind of a hassle, but it is fun. And you do get to see, man, when you're cleaning off concrete, it is fantastic. Just watch all that gunk away. You go, look how clean my patio is. Till you dig a big rut in your wooden deck. It's like, uh-oh, I should have paid somebody to do this. All right. We got a few more texts over while we were Vic was doing the news. A lot of people dislike ironing as their chore. I don't understand why. It's something maybe, I don't know why. I don't know why people hate it so much.
Time intensive.
It is intense. What do you mean intensive?
Like time intensive. Like
time intensive?
It takes a while to do it, right?
No, it doesn't.
I have a steamer and...
Oh, those are nice.
Those are very nice. That feels a lot less...
But they don't... Work. Sometimes you got to have pressure and steam. I'm a big fan of steam. Oh, man. I love it.
I like it in your iron, you like it in your locomotive?
I like it all over. I like it in my my radiators, everywhere. No,
your radio?
I used to have my... And it just died about a month ago. I had an iron that was the most incredible steam iron ever. It created so much steam, and it had a big, wide plate on the bottom. It was phenomenal. Phenomenal.
Was it from the 70s?
No, this was, it lasted about 5 years, maybe. I got a good long run out of it. Oh, man, and it had a really long cord. It was best iron ever. And it died. But because I never throw anything out, I had my old Steam Master, pulled that out of retirement. Cranked it up, still steaming. It's fine. Not quite as good. I have to put an extension cord on it. There are a lot of, you know, little things, but that's fine. My daughter doesn't like to iron either. My wife doesn't like to iron. Nobody. Just me. Because you know why? Because nobody bothers me when I'm ironing either.
Mm.
I go down in the basement. I pop open the ironing board. I can turn on some music. One of the dogs comes down, lays on the rug, looks at me. Nobody else bothers me while I iron. Because they know, you know, I might make them iron. Or, you know, give them some other chore. So it's like, oh, leave Dad alone. He's ironing.
I like that about mowing the lawn because it's,
yes.
Like, you know, just like it's me and the radio.
Exactly. Once you get out, once you start doing something like that, people leave you alone because they don't want to help. So it's like, you know, Molly would never come out when I was cutting the grass. Debbie wouldn't come out. It's just, that's fine. Whether I'm edging or whatever it is, I like to keep things going. But. As much as I feel like I'm capable in some other areas, and when you're a father or a mother, when you're a parent, sometimes you feel helpless. And that is the worst feeling as a parent. Dan and I were talking yesterday about feelings, how it's different when your children are young and you're around them all the time and you feel you can be there and help them and protect them. And then I'm at a phase now where my daughter has moved away. She's graduated from college. She's moved. So in reality, there's not much I can do to help her. And she calls and we talk about all kinds of things. Tonight she called as I was working on getting the show ready. And this is how the phone goes. Hey, Ma, how's it going? Somebody just got shot outside my building. I'm like, wait, what? Slow down. She's in Brooklyn. Somebody just got shot outside my building. I mean, how do you know? She said, well, because I have some people over, and I was working on this project, and I heard 5 loud pops. And now there's 3 police cars out in front of my building, and they're putting up crime tape, and the police are standing around. I go, oh, I guess somebody got shot around your building. Now, her building is not a multi-unit building. She lives above a nail salon, and it's the nail salon and her apartment. There's nothing else. And to get into her door, you have to have a code. So, but then she says, well, what if there's somebody in the building with a gun? I said, well, first of all, if there was somebody in the building with a gun, the police wouldn't be just standing around outside. There would be a lot of commotion and hubbub. And I'm trying to stay calm. And she goes, I said, well, did you tell mom? Yeah, I told Mom. She just told me, this is why I tell you not to go out at night. And I'm like, well, that doesn't help. I said, but what, I don't know. You know, she said, you're being really calm about this. I said, okay, well, what am I supposed to do? I'm in Chicago. You're in New York. You didn't get shot. So, you know, I don't know how else to help. Okay. I said, well, what's going on now? She peeks out her bedroom window because her bedroom is right in the front of the apartment. She goes, oh, now there's, some plainclothes policemen down there and the tape. She goes, and people don't even seem to care. There's people across the street walking with their groceries. And I'm like, well, first of all, there's a grocery store across the street from you. And two, it's New York. People get shot. You lived in New Orleans for 4 years. People got shot there. I said, people get shot at home. You don't want to be the person getting shot. But other than that, you can't. Life doesn't stop. You got to keep going. Like, oh, fine, you just don't even care. I go, yeah, that's right. I don't even care. Then she's like, there's a bright light shining in my window. I said, well, This really got her mad. I go, do me a favor. Don't pull your curtain back with a broomstick or anything. Why would you even say that? Seriously? You're going to say that right now? Why would you even joke about that? Because that's what you have to do. You got to joke about it. I'm like, have you peeked out? Yes, I'm peeking out right now. All right, what does it look like? Oh, that's a camera. That's a big light. Now I'm going to be in crime scene video. I can't believe it. I'm like, all right. You know what? Don't you have some work to do, drama queen? You got to move along. Keep going. I said, call me if anything, you know, really happens. I haven't heard back from her. So I figure she's fine. One, she's up in her apartment. It's not like, I don't know. But that's when, Dan, you have many years before you get this feeling of, boy, there's nothing I can do. Because really, there's nothing I can do. And you hate to say that to your kid. But when your kid's an adult, you hope she knows. Listen, while I can't really do anything, I'm glad you're not shot. I said that to her. She found that comforting, I guess. Who wouldn't? It's the least I could do. Tell her I'm glad she didn't get shot. Listen, when you call your dad looking for support and the best he can do is, well, at least it wasn't you. That's something. That's why I'm parent of the year. That's why I know what's happening.
It is a weird juxtaposition because this happened a year and a half ago. It was like a perfect storm of events. We do have an alarm system at our house, and I couldn't find my keys, so I had to borrow Eileen's keys, which meant I took a different door out of the house than I normally did. And this door doesn't like lock properly. It locks, but it's not like a very tight lock. And then, which we've now replaced.
Okay. So, in case somebody was casing your joint.
And it just
happened. Which door is that, Dan? The door in the basement? One more.
And so it just so happened we also had a bag of garbage that we didn't take out that night. And so something happened with a bag of garbage knocked into the door, which shifted it just enough to create the alarm to go off. And my wife is a heavy sleeper, and so she did not hear anything until the cops showed up.
Oh, no.
So I got this call from ADT at 3:15 in the morning while the show was going on. And so I had told Nick, I'm like, I got to go. You know, I got to go.
There's burglars.
And so eventually we were able to connect, and we figured out what had happened and things like that. And so, like, the adrenaline rush had stopped. And, you know, it's 3:40 now. And so I just walked back and I'm like, hey, everything's fine. It was just this happened and we're good. But it was a very surreal hour and a half.
Oh, sure.
Because like you said, I mean, you know, my dad who lives close to us had come by and, you know, the police had gotten there and everything was fine. Ugh. But like, I'm like, do I go back to work? Do I go home? Neither one, you know, like, you know what I mean?
Because you're going to have a hard time focusing. If you're here, you're going to be thinking about home.
Right.
And if you're home and everything is fine.
Right. And like, I mean, you know, you were in there. It was the weird boundary time of like, well, Bennett's coming in a few minutes. But like, do I call somebody to try to get a fill in? But it's an hour of the show. And like, you know, what do we do? And, you know, and you know, but. Yeah, it is a very weird thing when you're like after that rush of like, all right, thank God you're okay, and then what? Yeah, you know, you just have this weird, you know, I can't go exactly back to the way I felt, but I can't also live in fear.
And I've been nervous about her living there anyway. It's funny, when she was in school, even though New Orleans is a big city with a lot of crime and stuff, I wasn't that nervous because she was at school. Now she's in New York, and there's just, you know, having been to her place and been to her, there's something. But I can't, I'm not going to tell her that. I'm not going to, you know, every time I talk to her, I can't believe I'm so nervous for you. Because that's not going to do any good. So I got to play it off. Then she doesn't appreciate my sense of humor. I thought that the line about the broomstick and the curtain was fabulous. That was fantastic. Am I supposed to be doing traffic and weather, Dan? Is that what, you know, we're out here. People are wondering what the weather's going to be like when they wake up. They're going to wonder how they're going to get around down the roads. Esmeralda's sitting there going, I can't believe he forgot me. He was supposed to come to me at 3:15. He didn't come to me at 3:15 either. This guy, I swear to God. You know, it's 3:45, first one?
Yeah, 3:45.
Is that one? Well, that's perfect, because now it's 3:46.
I still thought that, though.
I know you did. Listen, I can see it in your eyes. I understand. You're looking at me like I left grease on a plate. I get it. I see how it goes. So now I'm just going to say this so everything, all the tension can, you know, ease up. Well, country music bringing us in. Very nice. What was that? I know that song. Where do I know that song?
Emerson Drive, November.
Hmm. All right. I'll trust you on that one. We have an update on a story we did the other night. An update. Remember the other day we were talking about Lance Bass, the former NSYNCer, and we were theorizing why he thought he had bought the Brady Bunch house in Studio City. He had put in the highest bid. He was told by the realtor, hey, congratulations, you've bought the iconic Brady Bunch house, only to find out the next morning that some evil consortium had swooped in and bought it out from under him. I theorize that it might have been Justin Timberlake in an act of revenge for some long, long forgotten slight on Lance Bass's part. But Justin Timberlake, as we know, like an elephant, never forgets. So turns out it wasn't Justin Timberlake. I was wrong, unless Justin Timberlake is a silent partner in HGTV, which we talked about last night because Dan is a huge fan of HGTV shows. So now you're going to be able to watch Dan a show where they redo the Brady Bunch house.
Wow.
But this is what I'm going to find strange about this house. As we talked about the other night, this house was only used for exterior shots in the Brady Bunch, which ran from 1969 to 1974. I didn't realize it went 5 years, the Brady Bunch. But it was only used for the exterior shots. Well, they're going to go in, HGTV is, and redo it and say bring it back to its 70s glory. But I don't know if that means they're going to try to make the inside look like the Brady Bunch house, or if they're just going to redo the house as it is. It says, one of our projects for HGTV will speak to those Brady Bunch fans. You may have heard that the house from the iconic series was recently on the market. HGTV is the winning bidder and will restore the Brady Bunch home to its 1970s glory as only HGTV can. Dan, can you clarify, how is it that they can do it as only HGTV can?
I would imagine it's their stable of experts and that can.
So it'll be a couple of characters, perhaps a husband and wife, perhaps two brothers, perhaps a mom and daughter combination. Who's the mom and daughter combination? I never watched the show, but I see and I think, those women are very attractive.
I have not seen that one either.
Swinging sledgehammers.
Good Bones, I believe, is the
yes, that is the name of the show. Very nicely done.
Yes.
Yeah, and I didn't know if the Good Bones meant the houses or the contractors. I think it could go both ways. I'm not lying. And, you know, am I objectifying somebody? I don't think so. I'm just commenting. These are attractive women who are also obviously very capable. They wouldn't get a show with, hey, we're really hot chicks who swing hammers. Can you do anything with them? Nope. But look how hot we are.
Although that is always an interesting moment in the reality TV show where they bring in the you know, after the first season or two where things are going well, but they need to spruce things up. So they find somehow the most attractive contractors in the area. And all of a sudden they're now guest stars and appearing on some episodes.
I gotta be honest, if I'm hiring a contractor, the last thing I'm looking for is a really hot contractor. I want somebody who looks like they've been building since, you know, they were building the pyramids. I want a guy to come in with gnarled hands. I want his boots to be dirty. I want him to still be using like a legal pad and a slide rule to come up with his estimate. I don't want it to be too slick. I don't want a guy to, you know, roll up in some fancy car, then or a beautiful woman to come out and go, hey. And then you just go, how much is it going to cost? Your roof is going to cost $1.5 million. But my house is like 800 square feet. Yeah, but look at these. Okay, I spent $1.5 million. Idiots. So they're going to have a team doing it like this. They're very light in the conference call that from HGTV. They're light on details about the renovation series, but that's it. So as we know, on Sunday, Lance Bass took to social media. He was very despondent. He did not get the house. It's a three-bedroom, three-bath house, 2,477 square feet, which is pretty good. It's been called the second most photographed home in the United States after the White House. So there you go. And they say Sherwood Schwartz, who created the Brady Bunch, picked this house because he thought it looked like a house that an architect would live in. He didn't want something that was too flashy and too affluent, but he also didn't want it too blue-collar. So he saw this house in Studio City and went, that's a house an architect would live in. And so that's how they picked the Brady Bunch house. And now Lance Bass is going to have to, he's going to try to buy the Munster house next, or the Adams Family house, or the Leave It to Beaver house.
Well, I was thinking that they can do right by Lance by having him host the show.
Oh.
Right?
Is that doing right or rubbing his nose in it?
Well, I think that's
you'll never
doing
live
right.
here, lads. Ha ha ha. This would have been your bedroom if we hadn't stolen the house from you.
You would have such bitter, like, just his announcing of everything.
Yes.
Like, right. Tonight we're doing the room over there that would have been my bedroom.
Yeah, this is what you call
it's
a kitchen.
Be great.
I guess.
Do you think Lance would actually have lived in it? I doubt he would. I would have imagined Lance would have like preserved it and served
you think?
It like the tour guide for like people who stop by.
No,
oh,
I thought
he was going to flip it.
Really? I thought he was going to live in it. I think Lance Bass needs some of that Brady Bunch house photo pub exposure.
How many bedrooms is it?
Three bedrooms, three baths.
See, that doesn't seem like a lot for him. I'm curious where
he's been a long
now.
Time since NSYNC was rocking, you know.
Yeah, but you know.
The pastel pants.
I hope he saved his monies.
Mm. Well, he saved enough to buy a house that was on the market for $1.885 million.
Right? So he's got money.
Okay. Well, he probably mortgaged to the hilt. I'm guessing
no down payment.
No down payment. He has to pay that PMI. Lance is in trouble.
No, well, I mean, there is precedent because Vanilla Ice has his own restoration show.
Yeah, but he actually does it.
He would be one of those gnarly contractors you'd welcome.
I don't know, maybe.
Well, because that's what he did when, you know, no one would hire him to
Right, exactly.
Anymore.
You have one, you know, one hit song is not gonna does not a career make. I'm sure he still gets, you know, residuals from Ice Ice Baby. And every time I say word to your mother, I have to send a check, which is, you know, that seems wrong, but yeah, that's his thing. You know who else? What other big celebrity is a house flipper? Is that Bradley Cooper? No, not Bradley Cooper.
Oh.
No. Who's the guy who plays Hawkeye in the Avengers?
Jeremy Renner
is a huge house flipper.
Really?
Yes,
yeah, he had done that before.
Yeah, before he got his big movie breaks, he and a buddy were flipping houses. They still do. He talked about. I heard him an interview with Stern. He was doing, and he talked about living in some of these houses that he was flipping with no electricity and no bathroom. And I'm like, dude, you're hardcore. But it was a way to make a lot of money before he became a very successful actor. So that's pretty cool. So I don't know if I'd hire Vanilla Ice. You know, I'd be afraid. I'd be afraid if he was doing electrical work, all the chains would cause something to short out. There'd be, I don't know, the pants. I don't think saggy pants are a safe thing for a contractor to wear. You know, maybe his subcontractors come dressed appropriately. But I see Ice walking in. Yo, 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 what's up with the plumbing? I what do you mean?
I heard he installs
to your
a heck-
stovetop.
I think the fridge would be an okay area for him because it's, you know. Ice, baby.
Oh, it's cold. Yeah. It's cool. It's cold like ice.
Aquariums because of his connection to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
How's he connected to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
Star might be too strong of a word, but provided songs for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Secret of the Ooze.
Is that right?
Yes. It's quite. He's part of the Madcap finale.
Wow. You learn something new every day. You talk to people who have knowledge that you never would have expected and never needed to know. But now I can't. Now it's in my brain. I'll know it forever. Secret of the Ooze. That's why you have to wash your towels more than once a week. All right. We got to take a break. Then it's news time. Then we're going to get into some things you should not say if you are over 50. If you are a man, you shouldn't say these things. If you're a woman, you should not say these things. No one should say these things. Thank you, Vic. Brian Noonan in for Nick D. Nick will be back on Monday morning. I will be here Friday morning. Mark Carmen here tomorrow in for me, who is in for Nick. So it's a third tier, three removed. Somebody texted in. We were talking about the HGTV, Lance Bass, Brady Bunch phenomenon, and they said, could this be an elaborate plot between Lance and HGTV to boost interest in both the project and themselves? Look at all the free publicity in the past few days. Could be. And listen, I don't want to say people are listening to this and jocking our style, but minute we finish talking about that, couple local news agencies tweeted out the story. I don't know. What do you think, Dan? You think we're being monitored?
Yeah, I mean, they're big fans. Yeah. I think that's what it is.
You think that's what it is?
I think that's what it is.
So imitation, the sincerest form of flattery? Is that what we go with?
Yes.
All right, we'll go with that. He said.
Hear it here first.
Hear it here first. Live and local, baby. All right. I am a man over 50, and I will occasionally say things that I know are very youthful in an attempt to be funny or ironic. I try to speak in a way that reflects my age. You know, I don't think I'm uptight or crotchety, but I also realize I'm not 25 anymore. So I try to avoid some of the lingo of the youth, just because it sounds dumb coming out of an older man's mouth. You know, and the same goes for ladies. There's a group of people. When they get to a certain age, whether they're scared of aging or they think they need to do something to try to regain their youth, they try to incorporate sayings that are popular amongst the kids, as I like to say, in an ironic way, in order to make themselves feel or appear younger, and it usually does not work. So in front of me, I have 50 things that no woman and 50 things that no man should ever say after 50. And I would like to hear from you, 312-981-7200. If you are a certain age, what phrase do you think you should never say? For example, Dan, should I start? Or I'll ask Esmeralda. Should I start with men or women, Esmeralda?
Men.
Men. All right, we'll start with men. If you are a man over 50, or I'm going to say let's drop it to 40, but if you're in your 40s and you still say this, know that you're right on the razor's edge of being a complete doofus, because you're still using these terms. I know, you're 40 and you still feel like a kid. You still think you're in the frat house. You're not. So you shouldn't say, let's Netflix and chill, if you're over 50. Because nobody over 50 Netflix and chills. You know what you do when you're over 50 and you want to watch Netflix? You want to go watch TV? Yup. And then the two of you go to your big Edith and Archie chairs and you sit down and you watch Netflix. That's
all you're going to go with Netflix and fall asleep.
Oh, that's a given. Netflix and snooze would be better than Netflix and chill. Another thing for a man over 50 should not say, it's not fair. Because a 50-year-old who doesn't understand that life's not fair is really dumb. You know, you should have learned life's not fair. Somebody should have taught you life's not fair before you get to high school. But then you figure by the time you're, 25, 30, right? You should know life's not fair. That seems late to me, too. You know? Here's something else a man over 50 shouldn't say. Let's drive to Vegas tonight.
Oh, why not?
Well, it depends where you live. If you're in Bangor, Maine, that makes, you know, it doesn't make much sense. If you're living in Pahrump, it's only like a half hour. Pahrump, Nevada. It's where all the brothels and Art Bell live. Let's see. You should also not say this. This I completely agree with. If you're a man over 50, Esmeralda, if you heard a man over 50 say, "She's my bae," how would you judge him harshly?
Yes.
Yes, you should judge him harshly.
Because they'll say it too with that whole I'm trying to be hip.
Yes.
Tone.
It's right.
Like, oh, no.
Yeah,
no.
And then if you, I bet some of them, if you said, what does bae mean? They would have absolutely no idea.
We didn't know for a while.
I didn't know. I'm going to be honest. I didn't know. I think I might have asked you, or I might have asked my dog. I asked somebody.
I thought for a while it meant baby.
Oh, that makes sense.
Like bae, baby.
Yeah. Bae, baby. Bae, baby. Before anyone else? Is that what it means?
Yes.
All right. Which doesn't make any sense. I get, you know. But fine, if you're 20 and you want to say that, or if you're a teenage girl and you're tweeting or Instagramming or Snapchatting and you want to say, look at my bae. But once you get to all these terms, once you get to a certain age, if you're a guy that says, I've started a blog and you're over 50, why don't you focus more on your life? Because nobody wants to read your ramblings. What?
But wouldn't that be... I mean, a lot of times blogs nowadays are more pictures and, I don't know, maybe more they're going towards like life lessons or travel.
Then just write a diary. Keep a journal. Nobody wants to read your, you know, how you're 50 and now you're having a life-changing experience.
What if you're George Clooney writing that blog?
Listen,
or a George Clooney-like man?
First of all, there's not too many George Clooneys. And we know just about everything we need to know about George Clooney. He's fascinating, and he's wildly handsome. That's all I need to know about George Clooney. Rich, successful, beautiful, successful wife, kids, great head of hair. I don't need to read it. Anything else he writes is going to make me feel like less of a man, if that's even possible. So I don't need George Clooney to write a blog. And if you think you're like George Clooney, you're not. So don't start a blog. Unless you've sold a tequila company for billions of dollars, I don't want to read your mind droppings. Just enough. Enough of that. Who wants to go skinny dipping? Something else a man over 50 should never say. I think I might have said that in my 20s once. Twice, maybe. I don't know. Would you like to buy my book of poetry? Dan, that was a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Legit question. It's more limerick than poetry. Naughty limericks. And it's not really a book. It's kind of a pamphlet. A flyer. Flyer would be more apt.
It's a zine.
It's a
zine.
Don't put out a zine.
A zine? Who puts out zines anymore? Is that even a
thing? There's a thriving community of zine makers.
Is there still?
Mm-hmm.
I thought the zine thing was a 90s kind of phenomenon.
Oh, no. It's still going.
Who's doing zines?
I don't know.
People who can't afford blogs.
Oh, you think so? Or maybe these are bloggers that have also learned Photoshop, so now they can do zines. Check me out. I'm going to write about... What are you writing about? Oh, some very niche thing. I'm writing about the pixels in 48-inch monitors. It's my zine. Are they all different? All different genres, all different topics in these zines.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Are they comic book? See, I hear zine, I think comic book. Are they comic books?
There's varying. Some are poetry, some are comic, some are just people's writings.
50-year-old man blogs.
I don't know. Probably.
Are they going through menopause? Good. Oh boy. All right. Let's see. Something else that a man over 50 shouldn't say. This dinner party is getting totally cray. I don't know. I'll sleep when I'm dead. Shouldn't say that. I'm adulting. No one should say I'm adulting. If you're a man, if you're a woman, if you're over 18, you shouldn't say I'm adulting. All right? Enough. No adulting. And finally, for the men, you should never say, if you're over 50, I prefer to go commando. You may prefer to go commando, but we don't need to hear about it. All right? We just keep it to yourself. There's only one person who needs to know. That's you. Someone may be surprised to find it out later, and that's a shock that they'll have to deal with, but not. All right. Because I am an equal opportunity offender, we'll get into some of the things that the ladies over 50 should not say. We'll do that after we check the traffic and the weather. All right, we're going through some things that once you hit 50, you just should not say anymore. We talked about some things that men should not say. We got a text from the 815 saying men of over 50 should not use any surfer terminology or any rap or hip-hop slang unless they are actually involved in the production of rap or hip-hop. So, yeah, hearing me drop some dope rhymes. Probably not what you want to not doing. You know what I'm saying? All right. Now we have to go to the ladies. Esmeralda, you're going to have
another quick text on the mail site. Hold my beer, which is
hold my beer.
Hold my beer.
Yeah, that's besides just being dumb. It's just not original. Once everybody's saying something, it's like if you're the guy who's still saying not, or that's what she said.
What's up?
Yes. If you're still using those terms, go into a dark room, sit down, put your head on a pillow, and just take a break. Because you're out of step. Things aren't where... I just saw Esmeralda run out of her booth. I literally, like somebody... like there was a fire. She ran like somebody was chasing her. Are you okay?
No, I was charging my phone in the other room, and I had set an alarm.
All of a sudden, it was like,
because I could hear it, and I was like, oh, no.
Is there anything we should know as we're all just fleeing the building?
I had an alarm set for some reason for 4:21.
That's an odd time.
No,
was that the time you... I know by 4:21, I will be completely fed up with this.
I think because I had set it for nighttime, 4:21, okay. And I didn't hit PM.
Oh, I see. That's still a strange time. It's a very specific time to get. I'll get up at 4:21.
I was half asleep, so I was just kind of hitting the buttons like, God, just
all
10
right.
more minutes.
Somebody texting in from the 708. It is what it is. All my kids say it, and I want to scream. I hate that terminology. I hate that term more than just about anything. It is what it is. It angers me as much as whatever. If you're a grown person and you say whatever, know that I really want to punch you in the head. I won't, but I will. All right, here's some things that the ladies shouldn't say. Esmeralda, feel free to jump in on these.
Mm-hmm.
Do I look fat in this? A woman over 50, they say, should not say that because it just screams that you're insecure. And I agree. You know what? You know how you look. Whatever, you know, you look how you look.
Yeah, but you want opinions.
To strangers?
Sometimes it could... Well, are you telling to stranger? You're telling it to people you know.
Well, I think it's this...
And who's doing
this
that
context,
to strangers?
Well, or just friends, you know, like if you ask your partner, do I look fat in this? That's one thing, because maybe, you know, you can't tell, how does this look in the back? You know, I understand those kind of questions.
Right.
But if you're out, like, with a group of the ladies, and you're all drinking your frosé, because that's what all the ladies drink now, Dan, I don't know if you've been out with the ladies.
I have heard that. I have not seen it. But...
Frosé all day. That's what I...
That's one they shouldn't say.
Yes, no one should say that. But they do, don't they, Esmeralda?
Mm-hmm.
You've been around the ladies who say they want their frosé all day, and I don't understand it. I don't know when rosé made the big comeback, you know? Pretty soon people are going to be drinking Lancers again. Remember Lancers in the brown earthenware jug? No, you guys are too young for that. All right, put another thing men in 50 shouldn't say. References to old liquor. That's all right. We won't do that anymore. Here's one that, according to this, that ladies over 50 shouldn't say. It's lit. Because everybody's getting excited about that. If you're over 50, according to this, and exclaiming that something is lit, it's only going to make you sound like you're desperately trying to seem youthful.
Yeah. I think, and usually when someone says it, they don't say it naturally. It's something they're like, what can I say? What can I say cool?
See, and that's another one. I got to be honest. I see people post it on their Instagram pictures. I hear people say it. I'm not ashamed of it. I don't understand what it means. I mean, I'm guessing it means it's lit up, so it's happening. Would that be correct? Am I
yes.
on the right track?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the last time you'll hear me say it. Asking what it meant. Because Dan, you have my permission. If I come in Thursday night and you say, hey, how was it shooting that TV show? I go, oh, dude, it was lit. I want you to take whatever heavy object is near you and pummel me with it. And then say, what did you say? And I'll go, I meant it was fun. That's what'll happen.
Noted.
Noted. And Esmeralda, you're my witness.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be, you know, when you see Dan pummeling me, don't call security. Well, one, because nobody has a number for security, as I learned the other day. Nobody, there's no number. It's nowhere in any studio. So don't try to call. Don't go looking for
it. They added it. I wonder why they added it. It's in front of me now.
Is it
because of you? Yeah.
Well, right. Because I raised a stink. We had to call. I asked five people on Sunday, hey, do you have the number for security? Everybody went, nope. So I think our fine engineer, Bob, last night went around and put those up. So that everybody would now have the number for security. It doesn't make sense to have security and not be able to call them. It's like having a dog and not knowing its name. You know, you just can't call it. All right, let me find a couple more for the ladies. Let's be bad and order dessert. I love it.
Yeah,
try to be
I
precious.
Hate that
yeah,
stuff.
It's like, come on. You want dessert? Have dessert. You're a grown woman. You're 50. If you're 50 and you think you have to sneak dessert because mommy's gonna be mad at you, you got some other problems. They say you should never say I'm such an idiot because you've had life experience. You're not an idiot. You're just fine. They also all right. I'm going to put this as delicately as I can. If you are a woman over 50, you shouldn't say that you're going to get some. You know? Get some,
what
Dan.
What should you say?
That you're about to, you know, They said you should be able to say the word sex without blushing at 50.
Ah, come on.
I don't know. I don't want to think of, man, I'm going to get some. Then they also say you shouldn't call yourself a cougar just because you want to get some. A lot of rules for the ladies. Also, you shouldn't call yourself a girl when you're 50. A girl like me. They say, don't do that. You're not a girl. You're a grown lady. What do you think of that one, Esmeralda?
See, some of this, I feel, is just in, you're just saying them in jest. You're not being so serious, like, oh, you know, a girl like me. It's like, no, you're probably saying it, like, in a funny way, whatever you're saying is very offhand.
I would hope that's the case, but somehow I feel it is not. I think we've all run into people, maybe you guys haven't because you're younger, but I've run across people my age who really don't like being this age, even though this age is not really that old anymore. You know, in prairie times, I'd be dead by now. But now, I don't live in an agrarian society. People to do stuff for me. I've got machines.
I can see that, though. Because, like myself, I kind of feel like I'm not a grown-up.
Right.
And I say I'm a grown-up. Because I haven't... Because, you know, there's a lot of things that, like, I don't own a home or a car or have children or anything like that.
Wow.
I mean, but that doesn't even qualify either, because, like, I'll be like, I'm like, man, I should really pick up that sock off the floor because I'm an adult, and I'm like, nope, not going.
See, what is that kind of like mentality? I think I'm just like, ugh.
Well, I'll be honest. I still, if I'm in a room with people my age, I will still sometimes think, what's with all these old people? But I guess I act my age to a certain point, but I still look around and I'll go, man, that dude is old. And then I find out he's like 2 years younger than me. I go, well, he's geezerly, though. I have a youthful spirit. That's what makes me, you know, I'll do top nudity on film. I won't do, as we said, the lower region. I won't do that. So, that's why I feel that I'm still youthful in a way.
Yeah. I mean, my mom will talk about elderly people. And I'm like, my, you're not. Like, I don't say this to her because I don't need to get the backhand.
Right. But or the iron.
Yeah.
She'll whack you with the iron.
She's up there. She's in her 70s now. So I'm just like in my head, like, my, you're not that. You're kind of up there.
Yeah.
You're in the elderly with those people.
I don't know
where
the line is for elderly anymore. I think to be safe, somebody's got to be 95 before you drop the elderly on them. Because at 95, one, they don't have the strength to complain or to fight back if you happen to mention that they're elderly. Two, they probably are. There's some 70-year-olds who are very youthful and lithe and sprightly.
I usually say older.
Right.
Older.
I like geezerly.
Sure.
Sure. I don't know if anybody else does, but that's just my thing. All right, speaking of my thing is listening to Dan, who is telling me frantically that we have to do this before news time. All right. Final 22 minutes, and then Steve Grzanich will be in here with the opening bell. Very nice. I just got to see Mary Vandeveld, who will be coming up with Steve Cochran later on in the morning. That was very nice. Hadn't seen Mary in a while. It's nice to come back in these hours. I miss the overnights. It's fun. So I thank Nick for letting me come in and keep his chair warm while he is on vacation. He'll be back with you Monday. Mark Carman will be here tomorrow, and then I'll be back again Friday morning. School is about to start. I know people are already, they're panicking already. The kids are thinking, oh, summer's already over. Yes, of course, summer is almost over. Kids will be going back to school in just a few weeks. Hard to believe. And they will be loading up their backpacks and trudging off to school, which is, it's one of the, as a guy who's been teaching for the last couple of years, I see these kids come in with these backpacks, and I remember watching my daughter carry her backpacks to school, and Dan, one of these days your daughters will go off to school, and they'll say, oh, you'll have to take them out and get them whatever the newest cartoon character backpack is. Perhaps it's a Dora the Explorer or a Peppa Pig, whatever the backpack is, and then they'll load it up with a million things and begin giving themselves curvature of the spine, which is a... Now, this is the first story I've seen, but the stories will keep coming from health experts that are saying you got to be careful with these kids carrying these heavy backpacks because it will hurt them. And I don't see how it couldn't, because, as I said, I watch these kids try to get, and like the school I'm at, it's not like when you and I went to school where kids actually carried books. Remember those days, Dan? Simpler times when you had to carry books. I mean, when you went to St. Pat's High School, allegedly. Right. And when I went to Ignatius, allegedly, they don't claim me. And they're probably going to sue me for actually saying that I went there. That's like, I am never going to win an alumnus of the year.
That's the real reason you're going to be off tomorrow, is because you have to be in court.
I'm going to be in court because they said, we told you never to mention that you went here. There was a cease and desist that was put into place years ago. The day after I graduated, I got the cease and desist. Here's your diploma. Now shut up. Okay.
The last check has been cashed. Yeah.
Time to go, Big Daddy. But even like in college, you're carrying books. In high school, we carried books. And I remember how heavy it is. Well, now the kids don't, in our schools anyway, they don't have books. They just have an iPad. But they've got the iPad and their charger, and they've got a bag that they have to carry the iPad in, and then that goes in their backpack. And then kids always have a ton of stuff that they're carrying with them, you know, whether it's a lunchbox or four extra hoodies or, you know, something. Because they always have, they have the hoodie that they wear, then they have another hoodie in their cubby or in their backpack, and because they forgot one hoodie the other day. So now they're just stockpiling things, and then they have all the papers that they should have emptied out, because now it's, you know, May 15th, and they still have papers dated October 30th. So they've never cleaned out their bag. So now these backpacks, you know, they weigh a lot. And, you know, I can't get it out. Especially the kindergarten kids. I always think they're going to tip over like a turtle and just spin around like bad, really low-budget breakdancers. But they, you know, it's one of those things. So the American Chiropractic Association is up in arms, as they should be. They send out a warning. Because they want parents to know. They recommend that your child's backpack weigh no more than 10% of his or her weight. Boy, that's rough if you got a kid who's, you know, like me, like a young Brian. That's going to be a heavy backpack. It'll be heavy. Very heavy backpack. Other recommendations go as high as 15% of their weight. Again, oh my goodness. Overloaded backpacks, they say, can cause back and shoulder pain as well as poor posture in children. Yes! Every child is walking down the hall looking like a shrimp. Not a short person, just a curved crustacean. They all have bad backs, bad spines. They're looking down. They all look forlorn, like they've been carrying, you know, big pallets of wood for days and days and days. If it's not corrected, many of those problems can become chronic and cause your children problems when they become adults. Yeah, they won't want to go backpacking. They'll never be on the Amazing Race. A lot of issues. If you scar them with heavy backpacks as children, they're never going to want to carry heavy backpacks as adults.
And that would be filmed by David?
Sure. He'll be flying above them, and they go, look at that kid. Look at that adult. He won't even pick up his backpack. Kid goes into like post-traumatic stress because he remembers when he was in second grade and he tried to lift his backpack up, and it was, a whole big thing. And then, God forbid, like the little cheap plastic hook breaks, and then they've only got one strap, and now they're just spinning around in circles because they can't get the other strap over
their
shoulder.
Right, because if it's one strap but not broken, it's cool. But if it's one strap because it's broken, not cool.
Right. And listen, I don't care what socioeconomic group your students are in. They judge. It doesn't matter. Broken backpack. I had a kid last year. I was teaching first grade. And I'm in a school that is not, you know, not very economically well off, let's say. And one of the kids was having trouble with his backpack because it had broke. And, you know, we were trying to do whatever we could. And, you know, we said, well, at some point you might need to get a new backpack, because we were like stapling it, or we were trying to use tape, and it was always breaking. And he'd cry at the end of the day because his backpack, it was like, it was a whole big thing, And it went on for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. Finally, I said, and because, you know, teachers are human too. And finally I went, listen, there's nothing else we can do for this backpack. You either got to talk to your dad and try to get a new one, or just deal with this one, because we can't, you know, there's 180 old staples in there. The kid couldn't have taken it through TSA. There was so much metal in this backpack, it almost qualified as Negan's bat on The Walking Dead. It was almost as dangerous as Lucille. There's a reference for people who watch one television show on Sunday nights. That's it. Or read a graphic novel. If you don't, listen, this isn't for everybody. Everybody doesn't get every reference. Some I spoon feed you. Some I'll throw broad. Some I go narrow. That's how it works. All right, so here are some tips to help decrease the risk that your child is going to hurt their back. There's nothing more depressing than a 7-year-old with back problems. It's horrible to be a 50-year-old man with back problems or an 80-year-old man with back problems. To go, oh, my back. But to hear a 7-year-old go, oh, my back, it's like, oh, no. You've got a long life of medical maladies then. If this, because they get up and they make that old man sound when they get out of get up off the carpet for circle time. Ugh! And you're like, who made that sound? You're like, oh, Mr. Noonan, my back, my dogs are barking. My back's killing me. What do you, how can your back be killing you? You, first of all, you weigh 37 pounds. There's nothing that is going to yank your back out of, you know, out of alignment. And two, unless you're, no one under 50 should make that, ugh, sound when they get up. I, like most people, I don't know if you've reached that point, Dan, because you, parents can make that sound too, because you're, you know, right, it's a hard life. Yeah. Hard knock life. You and Annie. Tough. It's very tough. Do you make those sounds sometimes when you get up?
I do.
It scares you, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Because you're like, wait a minute. I shouldn't. I'm young and spry. I should be moaning every time I get up. Every time I get out of my chair, I make those sounds. Now the dogs look at me. My wife looks at me. And it's a mixture of disgust and pity. And that's never a look you want from your partner. You know what? You know, you want somebody to look at you. They don't always have to look at you adoringly, but they shouldn't look at you and just go, oh, if it was legal, I'd just take him out back and put him out of his misery. You know, because that's kind of the feeling you get sometimes. And you don't want that feeling. Nobody wants that feeling, especially when you're seven. Seven, you don't want anybody thinking they should take you out back and put you out of your misery. All right, so here's some tips. Then we'll do traffic and weather. Encourage your child to pack light. All right. Organize the backpack to use all of its compartments to help distribute the weight. Sure, because you don't want your kid tipping over. Well, you got to distribute that weight. Pack heavier items closest to the center of the back. Go through the pack with your child weekly and remove unneeded items to keep it light. And remind your child to always use both shoulder straps. See? No being cool. Slinging a backpack over one shoulder can strain your muscles. So parents, as you wake your kids up in the next few weeks to go to school, with all the other things you have to do to worry about your children as they go out the door, make sure you're balancing up that backpack. And then do the complicated math so that your child's backpack is only 10 to 15% of their body weight. And then don't give your kid a big lunch, because that's going to throw everything off for the walk home. All right, a few more minutes, and then Steve Grzanich will be here with the opening bell after the news, followed by the Steve Cochran Show here on WGN. As I mentioned, Mark Carman will be here tomorrow, and I will be back with you on Thursday night, Friday morning. Lots planned there. We have some local filmmakers coming in who have a great story about a local business. We're going to who's our other guest on Friday? I forget who that is.
Herb Weisbahn, Consumer Reporter.
Yes, we got Herb is coming. We'll talk to Herb. We'll have the filmmakers. And Friday morning, it's the return by popular demand of the Overnight Arcade. Oh, my goodness. Will there be prizes? Of course there'll be prizes. Well, how would we do the Overnight Arcade without prizes?
Will there be Final Countdown?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if we use Final Countdown. I haven't, you know, I've got a nice new produced open for the...
Really?
Well, it's the open that we use, but it's a produced open. Because when we started doing the arcade back a decade... Wow. We haven't done the arcade much since we moved to Sunday afternoons. But when we were doing the arcade, it started... Like a decade ago when I was doing weekend overnights, we just played the Final Countdown. That was how it started. And then, you know, Cody loves to get in the production booth and whip up things. And so he whipped us up a big fancy open. So we'll see. I haven't played it in a while, so I'm going to have to listen to it because it might be, you know, talking about the Reagan administration. But people were asking, hey, you going to do it? And I thought, I asked Dan, hey, should we do it? And Dan said, I don't care what you do. So, you know, I was like, okay, if you don't care. What if I was racking up $45,000 in speeding tickets in 3 hours? Would you care then?
I would care.
Of course you'd care. That almost sounds like what I do when we first moved to our current home. And I started driving up Ogden, and I didn't realize that the city had installed these fake safety cameras in the parks, even though, you know, 11 o'clock, not many people in the park. But, oh, it doesn't matter. They have these Sneaky Pete cameras because, you know, under the, we're trying to keep everybody safe.
Right.
Really? Are you trying to keep everybody safe? Or are you trying to gouge people for $100 a pop because they went 27 in a 25? I don't know. I'll leave it to you to decide if the city is really worried about your safety or if they're just trying to generate revenue. But that's a whole other story. This is about a 25-year-old British man who racked up a stunning $45,000 worth of tickets in just 3 hours. You know why? Because he rented a Lamborghini Huracan in Dubai last week, according to a British tabloid. Now the man and the rental company are in the midst of a standoff over who should pay the fines. You would think that should be pretty easy, right? The guy should have to pay the fines. He was driving the car.
Yes.
However, that's not the case in Dubai. So, Dan, I know you're planning a family vacation to Dubai, and whenever you've got the kids in the car, you like to drive crazy fast.
Of course.
Good news, in Dubai, the rental car companies, tickets, traffic fines accumulated on a rental car are the legal responsibility of the company that owns the vehicle. Correct. But according to the newspaper, The Sun, the tourist who rented the car for 2 days still hasn't returned it. He can't, according to the company, we can't pay this amount should the car be taken into impound. It's still with the tourist parked at his hotel. The rental car company does have the man's passport, though, as collateral. So it seems as if they are at an impasse. The British man paid about $1,550 to rent the car for 2 days, according to the paper. He also reportedly, as I mentioned, gave the rental car company his passport as collateral, and the rental firm still has it. We've obtained copies of all the violations and immediately submitted a request for a travel ban on the tourist. He was speeding his Lamborghini. I'd be afraid to rent a Lamborghini, just because I know I would also want to drive 150 miles an hour one recent morning. Or any recent morning. 150 miles. What's the fastest you've ever driven? Tell the truth. Shame the devil, as my mom used to say.
Was not me. I think 117.
117?
It wasn't me. I was in the car.
It wasn't me.
It wasn't me.
Officer, it wasn't me.
Me personally, I've never gone over 92. I can tell you that.
It wasn't me. Who was it? Can you throw him under the bus?
Yeah.
You don't want to. Who was it?
Yeah, it was Wayne.
Wayne?
Yeah, Wayne.
All right. Just Wayne.
Just Wayne.
Just Wayne. None of your business. You don't have that. I'm not a rat.
Yeah.
Wayne. Let's go 117. Under what circumstances does a man drive 117 miles an hour?
I believe we were driving home from watching Fast and Furious.
Oh, of course. Now, did you Tokyo drift on the way home, too?
We did not.
You did not drift.
Speed.
Okay. You were. Well, that's the best speed to Tokyo drift. You pull up that emergency brake, you let out the clutch, of course, you got to have the big fin on the back of the car.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Well, see, that's like when you go see Rocky and you jog down the street
right.
throwing shadow punches.
Right, exactly.
You see Fast and the Furious, you shave your head and you drive like an insane person. I think I've gotten up to over 90. I don't think I hit 100. I may have though. But and that was like out west on the open highway when there's nothing around
sure.
except the deer and the antelope. And then I'm just
that's where they roam.
Right. I hope I don't hit them because that's going to do some damage.
Oh yeah.
But. I actually had a car back a few years ago here at the station. A dealership let me have a car for a couple days, and it was a muscle car. Well, if you got a muscle car, you got to muscle it up. So I took that rental car out down south, past the south suburbs, like out in the country. I opened it up to about 95 on a 2-lane highway.
Oof.
Nice. He sped and got clocked on these speed cameras 33 times over a 3-hour span.
I was going to say it had to be a speed camera, right? Because obviously yes. a cop would have just been like,
right.
hi.
So he was flying up and down these roads and the speed cameras got him 33 times, racked up $45,000. So let that be a lesson to you, friends. If you go to Dubai, they've got cameras, just like if you're driving through the park here and, you know, we're protecting the children. Everybody's got to be safe. Sure, just be safe. All right, let's do this. Then we'll get out of here, and Steve Grzanich will roll in and give you the opening bell.